Robert, you've got your.
Should be on mute, Michael.
Sorry, we just had a technical issue here. The chairperson of the council is going to be about 15 or 20 minutes late. So could I ask for a nomination for someone to chair the meeting until he arrives?
I propose Terry Anders.
Thank you very much, everybody, for the nomination to preside over this part of the meeting. And I'd like to take this opportunity to extend a very warm welcome to Roisin Calder and to her colleagues at the Trust, who are going to go first to make the presentation. So, declaration, are there any apologies?
Yeah, we have apologies from Councillors Owen, Stokes, McGuinness, McAvoy, Devlin, Hanlon, Gallagher, Howell and Hannah, and from the Chief Executive as well.
No problem. Are there any further apologies from online or in the chamber?
Chair, just an apology from Councillor Riley, please.
Thank you very much. Any further apologies? Since there's none, we'll move on to agenda item number 2, which is the declarations of interest. Are there any declarations of interest? I take it that there are none. So we'll move over now to Roisin. You're very welcome, and your colleagues, and you're very welcome to be here. So we'll hand over to yourself.
Okay. Thank you very much, Terry, and nice to see everybody. Can you all see us all right in the room? Yes. Okay.
Yes, we can.
I know that we've got you're very time limited, and you've got 3 organisations to meet with. So we'll try and keep sharing and discussing with you what we would hope to be the key priority areas for services that are provided by the South Eastern Trust. So for any of those that I haven't actually met, it's nice to see you. And for those that I've been working with for a long period of time, it's nice to see you again. Nice to see you, Dermot, on the screen. And others. I recently met up with Josephine at the NICON conference last week. Unfortunately, I can't see everybody else on the screen, so I'll share with you who's here with me in the room today. So I'm Roisin Calder, I'm the Chief Executive, and I'm joined by Helen Moore, who's our Director of Planning. Mark Neal is our Assistant Director for Unscheduled Care in our hospital services. Margaret O'Kane is our Director of Adult Services and Prison Health Care, and Damien Brannigan is Assistant Director for Mental Health Services. So, we will be able to cover some of the key points that you've shared with us that I know the Council are particularly interested in. And rather than send you a whole slide deck full of detailed information, as you know, I like to try and have this session as a sort of two-way conversation and a dialogue. We're absolutely committed to working in partnership with all of you to try and improve outcomes for our citizens working in the Down area, and you will know that. I think it links in very well with the community planning partnership that we have for Newry, Mourne and Down, and it's within the context of that, I think, that we are trying to frame conversations rather than just, if you like, delivering services and doing on to people. But it's really looking at how do we get ahead as a really proactive council, which I believe Newry, Mourne and Down is genuinely. Looking ahead at the pressures of providing health and social care services today, but also 3 to 5 years down the line, how do we want all of our services to be across our hospital and our community and our primary care settings? So if I'm going to talk really for probably about 10 minutes, if that's all right, and then I'm going to ask the others to give a short update on some of the key areas that I know will be of interest to the council. Hopefully, I know that often many of you, being public representatives, people are asking you for information. And as you know, you get right into my office seeking clarification. More than happy to do that. So in terms of moving through the pandemic, we do still have, COVID is still with us, although thankfully we are seeing the benefits of the vaccination. In terms of the vaccination programme across the council area, we are now rolling out the 4th COVID booster, and also the Trust of providing the flu vaccine to the public who meet the criteria. So you might be asked about that, and just refer to our website where you'll see all the detail. But for those who are over 50, people don't have to work in the trust, and we're providing vaccines at the weekends based in the Downshire. And there's a very, very good uptake in that. Our trusts have had the second highest number of vaccinations delivered, second to Belfast Trust, which is a much bigger area than us. So, again, thank you for your continued support and encouragement for the vaccination programme. It's very, very important. Just 2 weeks ago, across our trust hospitals, we had 80 patients admitted who were COVID positive. So, you know, it definitely hasn't gone away. Despite that, though, we are moving forward. And when I sort of say we're moving through this pandemic, we are moving forward. And there is a focus on health and social care services, trying to rebuild our services as much as possible to what they were pre-COVID. We are back now, meaning over 50% of our services are actually achieving or overachieving the performance targets that are set for us. We would hope to be in a place where all of our services are returned to pre-COVID levels by the end of March 2023. And it's something that we are very focused on. But I do, again, want to share with you something, and you will know this from the media and from the news, some of the real challenges across health and social care. And I know it's not only in our sector, but other sectors as well, you know, really been impacted by the cost of living crisis, by the reduced availability of a workforce to work in health and social care. That is very, very difficult. It's worse than it's ever been in my career in terms of the challenges that health and social care is facing. And as a result of that, these things all have an impact. It's very difficult for us to work in. And it's very difficult for you, I know, whenever people are asking, you know, when is their appointment going to be? When are they going to be seen? Why have they had very long waits in the emergency department, etc.? But that is really what's happening right across the UK, you know, for lots of different reasons. And many of them are out with our control. So what I suppose our role in the trust to do is to absolutely prioritise patient safety as the number one priority. And secondly, to do everything we can is within our own control to, you know, maximise efficient services and to be as productive as we possibly can. So one of the things I did want to share with you is the challenges from waiting times are absolutely unacceptable, as everybody knows. And the waiting lists in Northern Ireland now are now the worst in the world, which is very, very difficult, isn't it, for all of us to be even discussing when we think about the patients and our own families and friends and people that live in our communities. So what I would say is it is so challenging that I'm almost at the space now where a lot of public representatives would write in to the trust asking about a particular individual and when they're likely to get an appointment or when they're likely to receive their treatment. And there's just so many of these, and the position is very, very stark. So I'm really going to move to referring back to you to the website through the Department of Health, where quarterly all the waiting times for each specialty are on that. So I want to try and provide you with the information as much as possible, and then really refer you to ask the individual to contact our central booking service, central booking department, if they wish to check on their own individual waiting times, because I actually think it's getting impossible for you and impossible for us to manage, because there's just so many. The answer, if you like, the waiting times are published. They are very, very long. And everyone has to be taken in terms of, you know, chronological order and whether they are either a routine or a urgent referral. The second one as well I wanted to share with you, and again, I know many of you get requests, and I think it's a very difficult space, and I've just come off a meeting actually talking about it. And this is about the domiciliary care service in Northern Ireland. There are an awful lot of people who we need to discharge home from hospital, or that we wish to continue to support in their own home, and they need a care package. But the challenge is the domiciliary care model in Northern Ireland does not have enough capacity to provide what it needs to. and that's not going to be resolved anytime soon, sadly. So we have a lot of people who we would wish to go home from the Ulster, Lagan, Valley and the Down Hospital today. But due to the lack of a domiciliary care package, that is delayed. So what we're trying to do, as ever, trying to keep the glass half full and be positive, is to look at alternative ways. So we're not only using our domiciliary care providers, but we're also using a model called direct payments, whereby the money, the funding, is actually given to the individual and their family, and they can select another method of receiving care. But we are having to ask families to do more across Northern Ireland, and that is because there just isn't the hours available in that service. It's mostly provided by the independent sector, and you will know, again, it's very well rehearsed, it's difficult to attract workforce into this service because there's such a shortage in lots of other sectors. So people, you know, we recognise they perhaps earn as much money working in a retail environment, in the hospitality environment, as they do within domiciliary care. And this is something that is of great concern to us. The example in 2019 in my trust, we had 2,500 hours of unmet need for domiciliary care every month. And today it's 6,500. So again, I just want to share that with you because I know that people contact you and they're asking what more can be done. And there just isn't the service out there in Northern Ireland. And that's why I think this winter is going to be very, very challenging. We are expecting things to be very, very difficult over winter, but we will be doing everything we possibly can to look at how we work with the ambulance service. I've just come off a meeting with Michael Bloomfield. I know he's joining you later on today. Ambulance service are critical, working with our GP colleagues and our hospital and community teams to prioritise patient safety and minimise risk to patients. We do have a winter plan, and again, that's based around lots of different things that we feel we'll try and put in place for winter. And Mark Neil can talk a little bit about that. But really, it's suffice to say that we're trying to take a regional approach to managing pressures and managing demand. And then on a very positive note, what I would say to you is, you know, when I was talking again to induction, people who just started working in the Trust this morning, we are very fortunate in the South Eastern Trust that people do want to come and work in the Trust. And again, I think that you have a role to play in that. And I want to say thank you very much, because the Trust is seen as a good employer. And, you know, we had 67 people started, were on the induction course this morning. But really what that's to say is that we need to do everything we can to, you know, promote the health and social care services as a good place to work in and to attract good people who want to come and work here and develop their career in the Trust. And the reason for doing that, as you will know, is that out of all of our resources, 70% is spent on staff. So our staff genuinely are our most valuable resource, and we do want to support them as much as possible because we need them. And if we don't have staff to deliver services or care, then we won't be able to deliver the services that we do. So it's really important for us to keep the good people that we've got and to really value them and support them. And there's an awful lot of good work happening despite all the challenges, the pressures. So, you know, it has to be a glass half full in terms of leadership. So leadership from us in the Trust, and again, leadership from yourselves as public representatives. I absolutely make no apology for services that are provided across the Trust, because I am absolutely confident that the staff are doing all that they possibly can. Genuinely do mean that. You know, their hearts and minds are in their work every single day. But, you know, a lot of this is a Northern Ireland and a UK-wide problem. And it is genuinely without some of it out with our control. What I would say to you is, you know, what I am so impressed by every single day, every single bed in the South Eastern Trust is open. And that is not the case in some other places. And the reason for that is because our staff are turning up every day. They're going above and beyond. We're trying to manage that we don't have too many vacancies and that we can keep all beds open. We have all beds open, all right? And we are looking to maximise every single bed. There are areas where we've got two extra beds up in all of our wards, and that not just include general hospital, but also mental health wards as well. So staff are doing more, and they are working with us. So I just wanted to share that with you. The other thing is just a couple of small items to let you know before we go on to the wider conversation is that, let me see, yes, there is a threat of and a real potential for industrial action. So, again, you can imagine in the middle of winter, just if that does proceed, how difficult that's going to be for staff and for patients and families, you know, and I will keep close to you in terms of communicating where we're at in relation to that. Staff will have our support and they will have our understanding. There's no doubt about that. And again, I know that's very important for you to know. But if that does proceed, it will be very challenging. A couple of things, particularly in relation to the down area that that you had asked, was just again, sometimes, and I do want to remind you of this, if you do hear sort of questions or, you know, from the community or rumours, by all means, just come in and check with me and I'll find out for you. And I know a number of you do that all the time. So in relation to, you know, Finiston House, which is one of our facilities opposite the Downshire there, we have many of our community services based there. Just to let you know, that had been temporarily closed in the summer. But it was just because there was a flood in the building for a period of weeks in August. And now that flood work has all been repaired and we're fully operational again. Services have grown and expanded in the Down area. So we do need to keep Finiston House. And we've actually put quite a bit of investment into it. And the other thing, well, I'll leave it for Damien to mention, but again, our new psychiatric intensive care unit on the Downshire site, that's progressing really well and is going to open shortly. So, again, I would say to you, in relation to the Down Hospital, I'd be very keen at some point if Council Michael would like to have a meeting up in the Down. You know, I'd be more than happy to facilitate that again, because it's so important for you in your roles at the appropriate time. I know, but I don't know when elections and things might be, but whenever the time's appropriate, just for you to see exactly all of the services that are provided from the Down and see and hear and meet some of our staff. And I know that would mean a lot to them, and making sure that we're all joined up. But what I can say to you is every single bed is open and working in the Down Hospital, as are all our services and departments. We actually would like to do some more work there in terms of the regional day procedure work that we're doing in the cataracts up in the Down Hospital, and also in terms of endoscopy screening. And we're working with the region. There's fantastic feedback from patients about having their surgical procedures in the Down, and also about the urgent care model. The multidisciplinary teams in primary care, as you know, we were piloted in the Down area, and that was a great way of securing some investment. That's going from strength to strength now, and that's the right thing to do, because, you know, we really are getting upstream in terms of preventing people having to come into secondary care. So being able to access the physio, their social work, their GP, district nursing, mental health, community services, all out close to their GP practice. And that, I think it will be difficult to roll out, because I think central government, and you'll be as aware of this as me, there really is tremendous financial challenges, and there isn't the money to provide the services that we're currently providing. Never mind, look at how we develop new ones. My understanding is that in health alone, they're expecting a £450 million overspend by the end of March. And again, that is going to be very, very difficult in terms of public money available to provide the health and social care services that we would want to going forward to meet growing demand. And that growing demand is caused by lots of things. But one of them, which is, of course, is very positive, is that people are living longer, which is a good thing. But they also have to be more complex conditions that need, you know, specific services wrapped around them. So it's always important for me to sort of finish before I hand on to the team is to say to you that we need all the facilities we have across the Trust. We've got a resource of 12,000 staff working with us in the Trust across over 120 facilities, and we absolutely need them all. There is a role for all, whether they're hospital, whether they're community, whether they're mental health or children's services. We do absolutely need them all. But I mean, I'm sure that you will have heard, you know, you'll hear from me. Hopefully these are the key messages that a new assembly will need to take forward, and we'll need to think about how do we steer our community through this, and how do we get a better fit for purpose health and social care service, because we don't have one that can meet all of the needs of all of our people at this moment in time, and we do need to think carefully. I think at, you know, as a government, about how we want to change that going forward. So if it's all right now, Terry, I'm going to hand over for the next 10 minutes, and then I know we need to make sure we've got plenty of time for questions, up to four. So I'm going to ask Mark just to update about the down and Damien about the mental health. Is that okay?
Thank you very much. Just to let you know, our chairperson, Councillor Michael Savage, has arrived, so he'll be chairing the meeting from now. Thank you, and thanks for your presentation.
You did a very good job there, Terry.
Thanks, Roisin, and you're all very welcome, and apologies for my delay and my tardiness, but it's just one of those days that I was exceptionally busy and had to aquaplane the whole way up the road from Newry, so my apologies for the delays. But Roisin, I caught a good bit of your presentation there. Thank you very much, and I look forward to welcoming you to the Chamber in the not-too-distant future. So if you want to...
Hey, Mark, do you want to update just on the down?
Yeah, no problem. Just, I see there's a wee icon there over the chat. There's a wee red mark. I don't know if there's anything in there. We're not looking at it, but I don't know if there's anything in there. I'm getting a shake of heads. I think we're good to go. Okay, so, yeah, good afternoon, everyone. My name's Mark Neal. I'm the Assistant Director for Unscheduled Care. So part of my remit is to look after urgent emergency care services across the Trust. So just to give a quick update on where we are with services in the Down Hospital for you. So I suppose for context of this, in March 2020, I'll go through this very, very quickly. We made the decision to temporarily close ED in the Down for a number of reasons, including the vulnerability of a small team whenever we were walking into the unknown of not knowing what sickness and all those things were going to be like. And also the size of that department and the ability to safely manage people who would be presenting with symptoms of COVID and those that weren't. So we made that decision, and the team there were redeployed either to somewhere else in the Down or to one of our other two emergency departments in Lagan Valley and the Ulster. We then introduced a phone first minor injury service in that summer, in August. Followed by a phone first urgent care centre model in October of 2020. So that's obviously now just over a couple of years ago. And just to give a bit of a brief update on where we are with that now. So I think one of the things that I just want to note is that we have gone, I guess, from where we were about a year ago, where we were receiving about 1,000 contacts a month, and that's doubled to over 2,000 contacts now in August this year of people who are contacting Phone First, the urgent care centre. So that's against the backdrop of just over a couple of thousand attendances a month that we would have been seeing prior to the COVID times. And those 2,000-ish contacts now a month that we're receiving, somewhere in around 77% of those are invited up to the site. Which just over three quarters. The shift that we have seen of those that aren't invited up is this time last year, about 60% of those were being advised to attend another emergency department. So that might have been Daisy Hill, you're going to hear from the Southern Cross later, or the Ulster or Lagan Valley. That's reduced from 60% now to 50% because we've increased broaden the criteria of what is coming through the front doors, really to include all those medical presentations related to people with respiratory symptoms. We had been, up until last winter, trying to maintain the urgent care space in the Down as free from COVID for the same reasons as we closed temporarily the site initially, which was we have a very small team of both nurses and doctors. And that small team then becomes very vulnerable if there is a COVID outbreak there. So we were really keen to be able to maintain the service that we have to keep it free from COVID. But as Roisin's already highlighted, times have moved on. We've got the vaccine program. We are very confident now in terms of how we can manage people who present with respiratory symptoms. And that's why you've noticed, we've noticed that there has been that drop from the percentage of those that don't come up for appointment and where they go. The rest of those that don't come up for appointment are either just given advice over the phone as to how they can manage, or are referred back to their GP or some other community service. And we do that because it's important, because it's often then an ongoing chronic issue that their GP is looking after initially and continues to do so. So that's where we are. We continue to see the service grow. I think it's really important to note that the service that's provided in the Down, whilst we've got that urgent care model, we are continuing to grow and give better access to our healthcare professionals in the community. So that's our NIAS colleagues, that's our MDTs, that's our GPs, directly into the hospitals. That's for a cohort of people that we are developing a passport for. And there's probably somewhere between 15 and 20 people we've got now on that program who have a passport that the healthcare providers will know, NIAS will know about. And if they get a call out, they know that they can call in ours or out of ours and get access straight into the hospital for that person. NIAS and GPs and MDTs can phone in and directly speak to a senior clinician and then either arrange for that person to be assessed in urgent care or in our frail elderly rapid access centre, or arrange for admission to hospital if that is needed. And the reason that we firmly believe in the phone first model for the Down is about keeping people safe. We do not want people to have delays in their care. If somebody comes to any hospital and the Ulster and essentially every hospital outside of the Royal, this will cover in to some degree or another. Not all services are provided in every site across the region. So there will be protocols in place to get people to where they can get the best care first time. And we know that delays in treatment, delays in care do result in poorer outcomes. So that's why phone first is really important for us. If I look at those that need transfer from the Down to somewhere else for care, and that could be a sick child, it could be somebody with acute chest pain, it could be somebody with a fracture that requires orthopedic intervention. And less than 1% of those that phone first are transferritis, like 0.8% or something along those lines. Of those that walk in through the front door without doing that, it's about 13%. So you're 16 times more likely to require transferritis if you don't make contact, first of all. And that's a big difference, and they're people who are ultimately having delays in their care, and that could happen similarly if somebody was to walk in to any other hospital across the region, for example, be having a stroke and require thrombectomy. They all need to be in the Royal. It's the only place that does it. So what we have then seen is what is important. So I mentioned the rapid access, or mentioned the access directly for a group of people through the passport. I mentioned that our healthcare professionals in the community can get direct senior access to clinicians on site. So what that has noticed for us, and we challenged ourselves back in April, May time, was to have more admissions directly into that hospital locally without going through somewhere else. So we know that we've seen that pretty much increase threefold since before the summer. We've still got more to do. We still continue to learn and scrutinise everybody who has a pathway that is not the case. But we're confident that we're moving in the right direction there. And we will continue to do so, working with Mark Jones on there, continuing to work with our NIAS colleagues and our multidisciplinary teams in the community and our local GPs, because we do know that we want, absolutely want, local people getting care in the Down Hospital, where the teams in the Down can do a great job at delivering it. In terms of sustainability of the workforce there, the one thing that anybody working in urgent and emergency care will tell you, and it's the same in the Down and the same in Lagan and Valley, is nothing makes you feel more vulnerable, especially as a nurse in those units, as having somebody in front of you that you can't provide the care for because they're waiting to go somewhere else, and you're watching them getting sicker in front of you. And you're having, and that is, and has been shared by staff in both Lagan Valley and the Down sites, that the greatest vulnerability and the greatest worry they have about working on those two sites whenever what was coming through the door was completely undifferentiated, because they knew the outcomes for those people wasn't as good as it could be. Yeah, I just want to finalize the final thing is consultant-led urgent care model is open Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. And the reminder injury service that is led by our emergency nurse practitioners, 9 to 5 on a Saturday and a Sunday. And that's where we are.
No, thank you very much, Mark. So I think that's a very comprehensive overview of where we are with all of our services in the Down Hospital and our urgent care model. What I would say is other trusts and urgent care services are really keenly looking at the model in the Down, and they hear that we feel it is safe, it is sustainable, it's delivering for our local population clinically appropriate care. And the most important thing, and again, I would want you to share this with you, and I know many of you have written in to us, so thank you. Patient feedback is really, really good. So the patients like it. They like being able to phone. They like being told when to come up. They've got a time. They don't need to wait. And they're not having a wasted journey if they're more acutely ill and they need to go somewhere else. But, you know, I'm very happy that all of our services are absolutely up and running in the Down, and that we have got more admissions, and their admission, direct admissions are growing month on month, and our attendances are back to what they were many years ago. I still want to do more. I would like to extend the opening hours into the evening if we ever can. David Robinson's very keen on being able to do that. The minor injuries at the weekend is important to us. As you know, we've lots of sporting, local sporting facilities and things happening at the weekends, so that's important. And we also know we have a tourist population as well coming into the area. So Lagan Valley, they don't have the minor injuries Saturday and Sunday, but I feel there are rurality reasons and needs to provide that service in the Down area. So I'm glad that we've got such a committed team doing it. So I'm going to ask Damien now, and the councillor, and thankfully always very supportive and very keen to address the challenges and pressures in what I know is one of the priorities for Newry Moreton Down Council, which is mental health. So that's very important from our perspective that we share with you just the challenges and also some of the good work that we're doing to support people. And despite the environment becoming even more challenging with what's happening, I suppose, with the cost of living crisis and the economic position. So over to you, Damien.
I just, Margaret. Excuse me, Chair. I'm just going to turn around the camera so that you can actually, hopefully, there you go. See Damien while you're talking.
Maybe that's not a good thing. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Damien Branigan, Assistant Director for Adult Mental Health Services in the Trust. So I suppose what I firstly would say is that what Roisin described as the picture across the Trust, across the services in the Trust, is reflected in mental health services. We have been fully operational post-COVID for several months now, and we are facing very high levels of demand upon our services. And that demand is illustrated in increased rates of admission to our inpatient services, high levels of occupancy within our inpatient services, higher rates of referral to our community services, and I suppose an increased level of complexity in patient presentation, and that's illustrated in the nature of the referrals we receive. Now, we are now receiving more urgent and emergency referrals to our community services. So it's in that context that as Roisin described, we have responsibility for ensuring that we are providing appropriate levels of leadership to support our staff in what is a very challenging environment. But that said, we are continuing to invest in our services and develop our services further. So Roisin mentioned a couple of positive points. Just to reiterate, our new psychiatric intensive care unit will be opening in the Downshire site, hopefully at the beginning of 2023. Work there is progressing well. And we had a visit from the Minister of Health last week to our new community perinatal mental health service. That is a service that stretches across all of our community, including into the Down sector. And we are treating many women now and their families closer to their homes through either home visits or clinics. So work is continuing within mental health services to ensure that we are providing the services that people need. And that will be, I suppose, reflected in the implementation of the 10-year mental health strategy, and which is obviously being led by the Department of Health.
I've nothing further to add. Russell, unless there's any questions.
No. So, Margaret, was there anything you particularly wanted to mention?
No, not really, in addition to what Damien said. I suppose the other thing that we're very conscious of as well, while we focus on mental health issues, that the emotional health and well-being of the general population is also something that's on our mind. So I suppose whenever we get the opportunity, we're trying to promote the message of good emotional well-being for people. And, you know, some of the community groups that we interface with, we're working to support them to try to just help people look after their own emotional health, particularly in these difficult times, economically and coming into the winter. So I just wanted to mention that, but it's not just the services you receive formally, it's also what we can do to support each other.
And if I could just finish off by saying, you know, the health and social care services, you know, we are a very large provider of them for the Down area, but we're not the only provider. So again, I just want to, you know, remind you how we do our very best to work in partnership. And maybe you can turn that, yes. We work in partnership with everybody who provides services. So we have got a really strong network of those who manage and run our care homes. Care home sectors critical in this space are our domiciliary care providers, who are all independent contractors. 80% of our services are contracted out. And we work in partnership with all of those, and also then our community and voluntary sector. And again, you know, we could not do what we do every single day without the support from the community and voluntary sector. And on some of the examples that Nicholas McCrickard and the Down Rural Network are doing and leading in partnership to try and provide services in a different way for citizens. That's really, really important to us. And, you know, we spend a significant amount of the trust budget in supporting the community and voluntary sector. And again, that's just useful for you to know about how this is all joined up and how we can work together. So listen, I'm very aware, I know I wanted to make sure that there is time, you've only got up to 4 o'clock, to maybe allow questions, Chairperson, if you would like to, we're happy to take questions.
Yes, Roisin, thank you very much, and my thanks to you, to Mark, Damien, Helen and Margaret, for your presence today and your very detailed presentation and update. We appreciate it greatly, and it's great to have this information flowing to us on a regular basis. I just want to bring in, there's a few questions there on the chat. Councillor Sharvin.
Yeah, thanks, Chair, and thank you, Roisin and team. I suppose, as we always start, we cannot praise the staff enough for what they do. And we would certainly want to extend our thanks to them for the continued work that they do for the community that we all live in. Roisin, the first question I have concerns the $450 million overspend that you've just mentioned there. And whenever you hear of an overspending, the assembly that we don't have and not being in a position to help cover or find a way of covering that cost, it sort of does put a bit of alarm bells up of, well, what needs to give to cover that? Is there a possibility of you giving us assurance that the future of the Down as it is today is secure and that no services from the Down or any resource would be cut to cover that overspend or need to be found? So that's my first one off the assurance that the future of the Down as it is today is secure. The second question, and you sort of did answer it whenever Mark was doing his presentation there around the phone first, the minor and the urgent elements of it. But the question I was going to ask, is there any plans to change that? And you sort of answered that you would love it to be opened in the evenings. And you even touched on, you know, our local sports scene here, you know, matches happening a bit later. But you answered that you would love to do that, but at the moment it's not possible. But I take it you're continuously reviewing that, and if there is an opportunity that you would do that. But the third part, myself, Dermot and John, were up with the unions when they were doing their strike. And certainly listening to the environment and safe staffing and the pay rise and the mileage that they are facing. And I asked them if there's anything that we could do, and they asked us to raise those points, you know, the environments that people are working in, the staffing, and making it safe for them, and pay rise and mileage. I'm sure, as you've touched on, that the Trust are fully supportive of them and wanting to ensure that the staff are being paid right. And even from a mileage, you know, a family at work within the Health Trust, 3,500 miles at 51p, and then it drops to 30p. You know, that's not going to cover the miles that some of the staff are doing. It's 10,000 plus a year. What is the Trust doing from your organisation perspective of supporting the unions and the staff in getting a fair deal that does allow them to be able to afford while going through the cost of living? I am aware that there is staff members within the Trust that are reliant on going to food banks even now, you know, and that's scary and totally unacceptable that we're having people going to food banks. But thankfully, we have food banks to support them. So there are just a couple of questions that I want to touch on. Just on the mental health thing, again, we touched on this the last time you were here. It's fantastic to see the strides that the Trust are making and bringing additional services, which will be vital, not just post-COVID, but going through this cost of living crisis as well. So I can only applaud you on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairperson, do you want to take one or two others and then announce them all at once? Because there might be some recurring statements and give everybody an opportunity.
Yes, Rosie, I have only two requests at the moment on the chat, so I'm going to bring in Councillor Lewis, and then if you could come back on that then, and if anybody else wants to ask a question, please let me know on the chat, please.
Thank you, Chair, and just to start by thanking Rosie there and her team that every time that we do come on and ask something or ask for a clarification on something, you do come back to us, and that seems to be working well. Like Councillor Charvin, I would just like to put on record as well my thanks to the staff, to your team, and to the doctors and nurses up there. Hard work as you are doing. My three questions would be, you had mentioned about the impact on about the workforce, the impact upon your workforce, and it was just sort of to explore the areas that would be affected by that and what would be the biggest impact to that, to the workforce. Would it be that there's a shortage of supply of people coming forward to apply for jobs? To ask a question on the regional trauma network, to get an update on that. As you know, it's been something that I've been very keen on and keen to see it rolled out across the Trust as a matter of our urgency, to ask if there has been a commitment to the wages there, to ensure that they are ring-fenced, that the staff that we do have allocated to the Regional Trauma Network at the moment, that their jobs are safe and ring fenced. And like Councillor Charvin, I suppose that I would ask as well about the A&E, about the emergency department. I know from the update there that the phone first model does seem to be working, and that you are able to work around that and get some good results from that. But I think that the that the people of Down were sort of expecting that after COVID and after those additional pressures had ended, that we would be sort of seeking to move towards the reopening of the ED. You had said there that there was staff, there was an ED team redeployed elsewhere. It was a check, have they now been redeployed back to the Down, and are they currently all working within the urgent care on the phone for her model? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Councillor Lewis and Councillor Sharvin. And thank you for the positive feedback for staff and, you know, all of you. I know that you are very appreciative, and we do pass that on. We do feed that back to staff, so it's very, very important, especially those who work locally. So just a couple of things. Absolutely. The financial position will not affect the future of the Down Hospital. The Down Hospital is absolutely critical, needed, and all the services in there we will be wanting to support and strengthen going forward, Gareth. So we will need to manage as a Department of Health the financial burdens that are placed across us. But, you know, really, so many of our services are absolutely essential, and we must prioritise those. So, yes, there are always efficiencies in which we can make. We know that in a very large organisation. And we're looking at how we can make savings to contribute without having an impact on service provision. And that's really the space that we're in. And, you know, there are ongoing conversations with the Department of Finance and with the wider financial piece at Westminster in relation to that. It is going to be very challenging going forward. It has been challenging for a long time, you know. So really, you know, I always try and make sure that our teams are focused on the right things, which is patient safety and supporting staff that work in the trust to deliver the best possible services. And yes, we keep a sight to the financial position, but that cannot be the primary driver. The Down and all its services are absolutely vital. In relation to supporting staff, yes, we know about the conversations with unions and going to ballot. We are very supportive of our staff in that regard. We have always been, and we always will be. So I've actually just had a meeting half an hour ago with my lead, making sure that they are meeting with the trade unions weekly, that we're keeping very close to some of the pressures and the space that they're in. And we absolutely understand the impact of the mileage position and of pay on our staff. So it's a very difficult space, we know, for public sector employees to find themselves in. And we will do whatever we possibly can to, you know, we'll be keen to prevent strike action if we possibly can, because that has an impact on patients and clients. But, you know, should that proceed, then our staff, I know, will work with us. They always have. To prioritise patient safety, they really will, and that we will work with them also to allow them and facilitate any action that they absolutely feel they need to take. Talked a bit there about the urgent care centre, both of you. And the urgent care centre is provided from the emergency department in the Down Hospital. This is an urgent response service, and it's working very well. The people, as in patients who call, they do like phone first, and phoning first will be rolled out. It's part of the review of urgent emergency care, and it will be rolled out across Northern Ireland for the smaller units. It doesn't work so well in a very, very large acute emergency department, because obviously normally those people attending are quite unwell, quite sick, and it wouldn't be appropriate for them to phone first. They need to turn up to the emergency department. And again, that's very important for you to know, in terms of if people are asking you for clarification, you know, but why you do not phone first to the Ulster Hospital. And that's because usually people are very acutely unwell, whether they need to come by an ambulance or with their family, and they need to get there as quickly as possible. And that's absolutely the right thing to do. So what we're keen to do is to make sure that the services that we have there are sustainable. All the staff that were redeployed are a long time back working in the Down now. So that's very, very good. And we're also keen to do more with the other roles, so the likes of the emergency nurse practitioner role, you know, particularly in the Down, but right across in Ards as well, and in Lagan Valley in the Ulster. You know, they are absolutely fantastic how they are leading and providing services for people. Yep, we want to try and look to do more, absolutely. And we know that at a given an appropriate time, the Trust would be keen to hold a public consultation exercise in relation to what the model should be going forward and what's actually possible in the Down area. And then finally, before I just hand over to Margaret, is to say, you know, we're in a very different place than we were some years ago, in that we really do have a wonderful model across hospital and community services for the Down area. There's tremendous, honestly, there's so much good work going on, and it is thanks, I think, to having that joined up relationships and partnerships that we've been able to say yes to so many things. The multidisciplinary teams in primary care are what we should be talking about, because that's about keeping people well, preventing them coming to hospital, and enabling them to stay living where they want to be with their families as much as possible. That's where the focus really needs to be on as well, not just on the hospitals. And the final question then just is Margaret on the regional trauma network. Thank you, Margaret.
Yep. So as I'm sure you'll know, the regional trauma network is the partnership now going forward between the community sector and the statutory sector to support victims, in the first instance, victims of the Troubles. And there's been a lot of work done, particularly over the summertime, number of significant workshops to try to pull together our shared experiences of what is the best way to support people with lived experience of trauma. And goodness knows there's so many of them in Northern Ireland, but we want to make sure that the service, when it's launched, is responsive to people, that it's the point of access will be very clearly understood, and that there will be pathways that people can be supported along their individual journey, because, as we know, trauma affects everyone very individually, depending on their own personal circumstances. So we've looked at pathways for referrals, for assessment, for providing support and for treatment, right, the whole continuum of different interventions there might be. And I have to say, it's really brilliant to be working so closely with our voluntary and community sector colleagues as well, so that we all bring our experience and expertise to the table for the people that will be referred to us. At the minute, we are working on the practicalities of how to make it all happen. So I'm sure, as you can imagine, with so many different organisations working together, we have to make sure that things, as even as simple as what referral form we use, what assessment documentation we use, that all of that is very clearly understood, and that each of the organisations feel comfortable in using that type of documentation. So there's a lot of work going on at the minute. So it's really positive, and I haven't got any word yet about the official launch, but certainly when I get that, I'll be very happy to share that with you.
Okay, thank you. Chairperson, did you have another question for us?
Yes, yes. Councillor Traynor, do you want to come in?
Can you hear me okay, Chair?
Yes, I can, John. Yeah, go ahead.
No, as my colleagues have all said so far, it would be remiss not to thank and commend all the staff within the health service at the minute, because obviously you're providing a very integral part of society, and especially how we're coming through COVID and how we're trying to get back to normality and ensuring that people's health is being looked after and the welfare of the society is being looked after. I suppose we're no stranger to pressures, and obviously I'd say, Roisin, I missed a wee bit of it, but I would say that you've probably referred today a wee bit to winter pressures, and we see them every year. But I suppose in the last year, we've seen greater pressures with regards to our EDs, whether it be the Ulster, Lagan Valley, or the Down. And I know that in the past, one of the biggest issues for yourselves has been, I suppose, the lack of beds or the lack of capacity to be able to move people from the EDs into wards. And I suppose we heard this from staff on Thursday when we were at the protest, when they were talking about safe staffing and they were talking about staffing pressures. And some of the greatest pressures that they find is trying to ensure that they can take care of people whilst they're in the EDs, certainly, whilst waiting for bed space. And obviously they had been alluding to the fact that it was part of a problem, which is a greater problem, I suppose, across the health sector, and being able to allocate, I suppose, care packages for patients to be able to be discharged from hospital, so that then, you know, the flow can take place from the ED right through into the hospital itself, into the wards, and then back out into the community. I suppose my question today is, what sort of pressures are the trust finding with regards care packages and being able to allocate care packages or being able to get interest from care providers for care packages? And then the second part of the question would be, I know that there would be great difficulty in that because it's something that we hear. It's something that many of us will be directly involved in where we have constituents contacting us in relation to. But given that there may be a problem with care providers being able to meet the needs of care packages, would the Trust consider expanding the services that they can provide to meet the shortfall? Obviously, care packages are funded, and I could be very simplistic in thinking to myself that it could be a simple reallocation of funds from, you know, paying a private company to deliver a care package to, obviously, the Trust expanding its workforce and being able to meet that need. So I suppose that's just really my question, and how much of an impact would it be if care packages were able to be delivered, I suppose, on a quicker basis, how that would impact the other sides of the, you know, the ED, the wards, and the general movement of patients through the system. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Nice to see you, John, and thanks, as always, for your support. And I think this conversation, I'll just reflect on it, I think it has been a very realistic conversation that is looking at, you know, the line really is, you know, what do people need to make their life work? And they need to have care where they want it, close to home and in the community. And they want to have and they need to have care in the hospital whenever they need to be there. So it's very, very important, and it's right, and I commend you for it, that the conversation is not just about hospital services, it's about what happens right across community services as well. And that is so important to be mindful of. 85% of services in the Down area are provided outside the Down hospital. So in relation to the domiciliary care, you might have actually missed that bit, John, because I covered that at the start. But really, the domiciliary care model is struggling beyond. And that's one of the greatest challenges for us in the Trust. So we are doing everything we possibly can to support our domiciliary care providers. I had a meeting with over 30 of them there in the last month. And they're really, the big difficulty is they're in a very similar position to us. So they can't get enough workforce themselves. We have areas where we are adequately staffed in many of our services, but in other services we don't. So, you know, in social care, many social care, social work posts, we have maybe 40% vacancies. The model that we've tried to do in our Trust is to have a little bit of both. So 20% of the domiciliary care services are provided in-house by the Trust, 80% are provided outside by domiciliary care providers. So it's really, you know, we keep very close to each other, and we do support our staff, for example, have been going into the care homes as well to support the staff providing the care in the care homes, because I know very clearly is that the more we can do to support people to stay in their own home, you know, and support those providers, then the better that would be for usually what is a frail older person. You know, I think this is a question that's bigger than any of us. Whenever you're saying, you know, could the Trust do more? Could the, you know, the big challenge I feel is this is the only part of the United Kingdom where domiciliary care is free. Domiciliary care is managed by local councils and is paid for in other countries in the United Kingdom. And there are tremendous challenges associated with that. And there has been the review of adult social care. And Margaret's going to mention a little bit about that. It might be quite useful. But I think the rate that is paid to domiciliary care workforce does need to be adjusted. And I do also think we need to think about, you know, across Northern Ireland, well, when we've only got so much resource at central government level, what is it that the public purse needs to be spent on? and how realistically, you know, is it realistic to provide all of these services free at the point of delivery? Because, you know, it will be the politicians that decide how much money comes in and where that money goes. It really will. And, you know, I hope that these tough conversations and ways forward are really going to be debated going forward. And then we, as we will provide whatever services we are commissioned to provide, and that's really the space we're in. We've got 6,500 unmet hours per month in the South Eastern Trust alone. So you think about that going forward over winter. It's just not there. Doesn't matter. It's not about money because it's not there. It's the capacity's not there. Margaret, would there be anything that you would want to add? Because Margaret's more expert than me, of course.
Well, I don't know about expert, but I suppose a couple of things come to mind. And it's a bit of a hobby horse of mine. It's about the role of health and the role of society. And there is something about the world we live in now where, you know, the message about looking out for your older neighbour or whatever, you know, shopping, that sort of thing. People don't do as much of that as they used to do, which is a pity, and we might, I think, be well served to try and encourage that public support message to support the health service. But as well as that, there are other advances that might reduce the need for the demand for domiciliary services, such as technological advances. So there are ways to help people be more independent in their own home. And that has worked very well, particularly I would work with people with a disability as well. And around, you know, so that's a double win. Someone doesn't need someone to come in and help them with something that they can have a piece of equipment that helps them to be as independent as themselves. So I think that's a good thing too. The other thing that Roisin mentioned earlier on was direct payments. And that's when, if you know someone that you would like to employ yourself to meet your needs, mm-hmm. instead of getting a domiciliary care worker, you can employ your own support worker. And we have brilliant examples of where good neighbours actually end up becoming the support worker for someone they know very well. So we've seen a growth in that, and I think we'd be keen to encourage that further. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is I don't think there is a silver bullet for the situation. I think we need to consider a range of options. And I suppose the other obvious option as well is, what is the housing stock like? Do people's homes support them to be as independent as they can? Actually, I don't think in Northern Ireland we're great with that. So certainly in terms of future housing plans, and we keep close to the housing executive, our occupational therapists are real experts in trying to help them design homes that actually promote independence and support people to stay in their own homes for as long as possible. So I think there are a myriad of things that we need to bear in mind.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, folks, I have no further questions. So all I'd like to do is reiterate my thanks for you all for coming along this afternoon, Roisin, Mark, Damien, Helen and Margaret, and also for the very lengthy and detailed information you provided us with. We are making progress, and I'd like to thank you and your team, Roisin, for the work that you're doing, and most importantly, keeping us informed. I think it's very important when things are when we face challenges, you keep us informed, but also when things are starting to work and starting to knit together and the community are engaging, that we get the feedback from yourselves that there are positive moves, because the healthcare of our people and our citizens is critical. You know, to you and all the team working on the front line, you have our heartfelt thanks for the work that you're doing on the ground to try and keep our people healthy and safe. And wish you well, and hopefully we'll see you again soon. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much, everybody. And we really appreciate this relationship, and the dialogue is extremely important to us. You will know that. And I always want to say to you, please, if you hear anything you're concerned, to contact us in the first instance and to support us in every way you possibly can, because public messaging is more your responsibility than mine. So keen to keep working with you. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, thanks very much. Stay home. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Good morning, everybody. You're very welcome. Apologies for the delay. We were overrun slightly in another meeting. I'm delighted to welcome Seamus Mullen, Head of Planning, and Mark Cochran, Assistant Director of Operations for the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service. And if you're happy enough to go ahead, Seamus or whoever's going to lead, give us your presentation. And then if you're happy enough, I'll bring questions and comments in from councillors when both of you have finished, if that's okay. So I see you there as well.
Chair, thank you very much. And thank you to your colleagues as well for the invitation to be with you at your special council meeting. Can I start maybe just by apologising as well on behalf of my Director of Operations, Rosie Burton, and also the Director of Planning, Performance and Corporate Policy, Maxine Patterson. Unfortunately, both have succumbed to the effects of COVID. So as you say, you've got myself and Seamus here today, and hopefully we can answer the questions you would have. We plan just to bring us a quick presentation, just covering what services we provide in your council area, some of the challenges that we're currently facing, what our plans look like going forward, and as you say, answer any questions that you might have. So we'll move on to slide one, and this is just really just an overview of the breakdown of NIOS services within the council area, and it straddles two of our divisions, both our Southern Division and our Southeast Division. And across that, next slide there, Seamus, we have five 24/7 stations located in Newry, Kilkeel, Ballinahinch, Newcastle and Downpatrick. And from those stations, we supply seven day shifts, double crewed ambulances, and seven night shifts. So a total of 14 resources across the 24-hour period. That's supplemented using rapid response vehicles, which operate between 7 in the morning and midnight, and then some non-emergency services as well. In terms of our clinical makeup then, that's 54 paramedics, 36 EMTs, 17 ambulance care assistants, and then a number of operational managers and support services. That's our funded establishment within your council area. So probably of some more interest, the next slide then is some of the detail around the activity. So year to date within the council area, we have received and attended 6,464 calls. That's roughly around 8% of the total activity for the ambulance service across the entire region in that period. And of those 6,500 calls, roughly 500 of those have been to what we consider our most serious category. That's a Category 1 call. And just to explain to Council in relation to how we categorise, so every call that's received in our emergency control centre is triaged in terms of its clinical acuity. So Category 1 calls are immediately life-threatening calls, such as cardiac or respiratory arrest. And our operational standard would suggest we should be responding to those within 8 minutes. Category 2 calls, those are serious conditions that require rapid assessment and probably transport to hospital. Examples would be stroke or chest pain, and we have a target of an 18-minute response time. Then Category 3, more urgent conditions such as a diabetic patient that require treatment but may or may not require transport, and we have a 2-hour response time on those. And then Category 4, patients who are basically stable clinical cases, non-urgent problems, and we have a 3-hour window of performance. So looking at those response times, and particularly for your area compared to the region, targets are a challenge for us, and I'm sure you've heard that from our colleagues in South East Trust, and again, you will hear that from the Southern Trust as well. And our Chief Executive is on record as acknowledging that patients are coming to harm as a result of the delays in getting ambulances to them in a timely way. Patients' conditions worsen the longer they have to wait, and as a result, there are poor outcomes when treatment has been delayed. That in itself places enormous stress and strain on our call handlers in our control rooms, our dispatchers, our clinicians who are responding, and our colleagues in the emergency departments who are having to juggle very, very difficult situations on a minute-by-minute basis every day. And that's a significant factor and adversely affecting the staff health and well-being within NIOS, as well as job satisfaction, skill fade, professional development and attrition. And those are some of the hidden costs of those delays. And I suppose looking at that chart there in particular, it's very clear to see that in terms of the target times that I give you for Cat 1 through to Cat 4, the Newry and Mourne and Down area, we're not achieving any of those targets in any of those categories. And you can see the regional picture there as well. And again, we're not achieving there either. So very quickly, I'm moving on to some of the challenges, and we'll just move on to the next slide as well, Seamus. So the historic increase in demand that we're experiencing at the moment, along with the wider system pressures that you've heard about already and you're aware of, it means that there's a significant proportion of our resources which are held unproductively outside emergency departments on a daily basis. Our biggest challenge at the moment is undoubtedly ambulance handover delays. They were a problem before the pandemic, but post-pandemic or in the recovery stages that we're in at the moment, the number and length of those delays have really just gone off the scale. We're currently losing about 25% of our capacity on a daily basis due to handover delays. And if you remember back to what I said at the start, in your council area, there are 14 crews on every day, 7 day shifts and 7 night shifts. And that in effect reduces us to between 10 and 11 crews. Those delays, as I've said, result in harm to patients waiting outside the departments, but also harm to the patients who are waiting for us to respond. When we're at EDs, we can't be responding to calls. However, I would say that the problem of ED handover delays is not unique to this council area or to NIOS, or indeed in the wider context of the UK Ambulance Services, as well as our National Ambulance Services colleagues in the Republic of Ireland. Ambulance services throughout the UK don't have sufficient capacity to manage our existing workload. The single biggest difference we could make is if we could eliminate delays of over 1 hour, that would have the biggest impact on our ability to respond effectively to Cat 1 and Cat 2 calls. It wouldn't be the total solution. There are other things that we need to achieve as well, not least, as you can see there, our clinical response model. A business case is currently with the department in relation to that, and also in terms of our recruitment and our ability to actually hold on to staff in what now is regarded not just as an extremely stressful role, but because of the increased number of attacks on our staff, can also be considered quite a difficult role in terms of those challenges. One other thing we thought we should touch on just today, the councillors, particularly in the Newry area, will be aware of the surgical divert process that was put in place earlier on in the summer. This is just to give you an overview of the impact that has had on us. You can see there from the figures, roughly between 1 and 2 calls per day. Not in itself a huge number, but when you take everything else in the context and you take the fact that crews are out of their area for that period of time, you can see the impact these changes in healthcare provision has on us. So I said I would touch a little bit on opportunities, and there are opportunities within the system to change how we do things to improve. I've talked there first about community first responders, and I'll maybe come back to that in the next couple of slides. But in terms of our own service developments, one way to help manage, to try and to manage the capacity issues we have, is to try and reduce demand. Reduction of demand can be achieved by bolstering the resources, we've talked about that, but also clinically supported triage ensures that patients receive the right care at the right time and in the right place. Decisions not to dispatch, which are made in our control centres through hear and treat protocols, are not to convey patients to hospital, which are made by clinicians in face-to-face assessment, requires skilled clinical assessment and differential diagnosis. These decisions are supported by advanced paramedic practitioners and other specialist roles, such as nurse practitioners, who we have now started to employ within our control centres on our clinical service desk. An increase in the number of referral pathways we've had available to us, and again, I came in and I heard some of the conversation with South Eastern Trust colleagues around those. In terms of community-based health and care services, increase the number of patients that we can safely and effectively discharge in the community. And again, that reduces avoidable conveyance to hospital. So if I could just move on then to the community first responders. And again, I think it would be remiss of me not to touch on this today because they play such a valuable role into what we're trying to achieve with local communities. And there are three within your council area. The Mourns Community First Responder Scheme has 16 members. And you can see there that from we started recording in March 2022, they've attended 83, as we refer to, alerts, roughly about 14 per month. Sleeve Crewe, which has the biggest membership at 21, they've been going most recently from May 2022, 10 calls per month, a total of 44 in that period of time. And the third community first responder scheme is within the Cross McGlen area. It's been going the longest. Unfortunately, I only have the figures since 2017, but you can see there that equates to around 6 alerts per month. So moving on to just some of our service developments, you will probably have heard the terminologies or you've maybe met and seen hospital ambulance liaison officers. Whenever I started in the ambulance service, a liaison officer was only deployed to a hospital in the event of a major incident. I think it's indicative of the pressures that we see now that these liaison officers operate at most of our major EDs on a 24/7 basis. So within the catchment area of your council, there is a service at the Ulster Hospital, which runs from 7 in the morning through to midnight. Daisy Hill is a more ad hoc arrangement because we don't have funding there, but we still try and put a liaison officer in there between 1,200 hours and 2,100 hours each day. The helicopter emergency medical service, the big red ambulance in the sky that many of you will be familiar with, continues to grow in strength. Over 3,000 operations now has flown since its inception back in 2017. Recently replaced the aircraft and currently now also helping to train critical care paramedics, which will provide even more advanced care to patients in the community. We also have a programme of recruitment of both qualified paramedics and newly qualified paramedics across the UK. And since April of this year, that has resulted in 17 additional staff joining the organisation. And of course, we now have our BSc degree course with our partner at the Ulster University. NIAS, unfortunately, is no longer able to train paramedics in its own right. And to gain registration, paramedics must have completed the BSc. That programme is now in its second year. Some 40 students in both years. So when that starts to complete at the end of year three after next year, then that will be a source of paramedics for NIAS in the region of 40 each academic year. We're just about to finish off our final foundation programme of paramedics, and there are around 40 staff on that, and they're due to arrive with us just the week before Christmas. So I guess they can expect Christmas at NIAS this year. At least that's what they tell us. So at this stage, I'm going to hand over to Seamus now, and Seamus is going to go through some of the unscheduled care work that we're doing as well.
Thanks very much, Mark, and thank you very much, Council, for the invitation this afternoon. As Mark said, I'm going to take you through some of the initiatives that we're looking at within the context of unscheduled care. You'll have heard Roisin and her team earlier on talk about the concept of flow, and I heard some of the councillors mention flow earlier on as well, and that's something that's significantly important in terms of the effectiveness of NIAS and how we operate. I mean, we operate within a wider health and social care system, NIAS is obviously a regional organisation, but a lot of our performance and our services depend on relationships working alongside the trusts in your area. So both Southern Trust and Southeastern Trust, we work very closely with them. Over the past number of months, we've been working as a team with all five trusts to look at improving the community response across urgent and emergency care right across Northern Ireland. And there's a number of initiatives that I wanted to draw to your attention this afternoon. The first one is looking at, we look at maximising alternative destinations for patients outside of emergency departments. Not all patients who call 999 actually, ED isn't always the most effective place for them. So what we do is we've looked at a range of pathways that are available to us across the region to allow us to provide alternative destinations for those patients. At the minute in the southern area, we have around about, I've just checking before I come on to the meeting here, we have around about 15 different pathways for patients who are in urgent need of care, and we have three acute pathways operating in your area. And I'll just give you an idea of two of them, because I don't think we've time to go through 15, but two of them that'll probably be very, very relevant to yourselves. I know mental health was mentioned earlier on in the questions to Southeastern Trust, and we do have an alternative pathway for patients who call NIAS from your area who have mental health issues. And for example, the Lifeline service operates across Northern Ireland. We do have a pathway across into Lifeline, and that's for patients who would consent to our control room staff facilitating a call across into the Lifeline service. Those patients may well have suicidal thoughts and behaviours, or they may well be in distress or despair. And to give you an idea of, in the near and more down area, we would deal with around roughly 3 to 4 patients per day calling through from near and more and down who would have who would fit that criteria. So Lifeline is one patient pathway. Another one is falls. Falls account for about 10% of all of the calls that would come into NIAS across the year. So it's quite a significant area of work for NIAS, and it would indeed account for the vast majority of calls for patients that are aged over 65 coming through into NIAS, but not all of those patients require a 999 response or transportation to ED or an ED attendance indeed. So we have a number of pathways operating in your area for that. There's two in particular. There's one referral across to Falls Coordinator Service that operates in the Southern Trust area, and there's also a referral across for our patient care service who can go out and operate a service with a razor chair to actually provide an assessment of that patient whether or not they need to attend ED. It's an iStumble assessment. And also, we can provide a razor chair to actually raise the person back up again from a fall. So that's two of the pathways that are existing at the moment in the area. As I say, there's 15. Another area of work that we're looking at is re-establishing pre-COVID ambulance handover zones. Mark referred earlier on to the length of time that patients can wait at the minute, and you'll have seen that on the news, not only here in Northern Ireland but across the UK. And patients can come to harm, and as Mark said, our chief executive is on record in saying that. What we're doing is we're re-looking at handover zones to enable us to cohort patients with NEDs rather than have them wait on the back of an ambulance, which isn't the ideal place for them. And the third initiative on that slide there is for NIAS to enhance our ability to prevent attendances at EDs. I mean, ideally, the best case scenario is to prevent people going to an emergency department in the first place. So we are looking at increasing what we call our hear and treat rates within the clinical support desk, and we're looking at expanding the multidisciplinary approach within the team at the minute. And what that actually looks like is we're looking at employment of mental health professionals within the control room to help de-escalate patients who may be calling in and who are in emotional distress or despair, who are low acuity mental health patients that are coming through. So it's to allow us to safely de-escalate those patients over the phone without the need to attend an emergency department. The next slide there, again, you heard Mark refer to this and Roisin and her team from Southeastern Trust. And what we're looking at with the other five trusts is improving the kind of pull of patients through the system from community right through to the other side again to discharge. And we're meeting with all of the five trusts. So over the last couple of weeks, we've been doing that, in particular in advance of the winter pressures, to look at how we can improve the productivity of the discharge coming through to the different hospitals. And the last one is we operate in a very kind of data-rich environment. We have a huge amount of data on patients that are coming through to NIAS, and overlaying that with data in the trusts, we are supporting a regional data development workstream within the SPPG, which is the old board. And we're working on a system-wide basis across Northern Ireland now to take that data and to help us plan better services for the future. So there's a huge amount of kind of strategic long-term work going on at the minute. But again, just making the point that a lot of that's happening not just within NIAS, because while we have a very important role at the Centre of Urgent Emergency Care, we need to be working with other partners to help achieve that as well. So I hope that gives you a bit of an overview of what we're doing at the moment. I'll stop sharing the presentation at this stage, and there's an opportunity for questions.
Thanks very much, folks, for that very comprehensive overview. I'm ready to take questions if people want to put them into the chat. At the minute, there's nothing there. Are there any comments? Sorry, Councillor Lewis.
Thank you. Sure, I had a question surrounding what more we could do to tackle the delays, but I would like to thank my markers for a very comprehensive review, and he has laid out what the Almond Service and what the Trust are doing to tackle those and to bring the delays down. I would just like to pay tribute to the Slieve Croob first responders team, and indeed all those teams that are working across our council area, and to ask how that relationship's going, and is that easing any of the pressure there? And secondly, to hear more on the amount of staff that the Almond Service could be using. I know that they have a rolling recruitment campaign, and that's good to see, but it's just sort of get a feel on how short staff that actually are. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, happy to pick up on that. Firstly, thank you very much for your kind words of support for our staff. There is no doubt that the environment, the circumstances that they're currently working in is probably as challenging as it has ever been in the ambulance service, but that's reflective of the wider healthcare environment at the moment. Certainly in terms of what can be done to help, and you mentioned the community first response schemes, and again, we have three up and running in the council area, and we would certainly welcome any interest in any additional schemes. We have our own dedicated community first response team led by Stephanie Leckie, who will be more than happy to work with people in local communities to understand what it is they can do to, in effect, help themselves. One of the other key things that we hope to focus on going forward is around health promotion, prevention, that type of work, and get back now into our community education programs that were unfortunately put on hold as a result of the pandemic. That again would be an area there that you can encourage your constituents, that if we can be of any help in that respect, then I'm certainly would be more than keen to do that. In terms of, you mentioned some of the challenges around delays there again. I mean, it's quite interesting. I don't think I could have scripted this if I had tried, but just to give you an indication of how things, the pressures we're under at the minute, we monitor constantly, and the top five ambulance handover delays at the moment, four of those are all within the Newry and Mourne and Down Council area, at the Ulster Hospital, Daisy Hill Hospital, basically, with the worst of those being now over 5 hours. So you see how that can impact. So yeah, happy with any help, and certainly to pick up outside and to give you any more sort of guidance if there's anything else we can do.
Okay, thanks very much, folks.
Sorry, I maybe missed there in terms of you mentioned about recruitment as well, Councillor, and I apologise, I missed coming back on that. The role in recruitment continues. We also, as you've seen in some of the slides there, have a very ambitious business case proposal with relation to our clinical response model. And if we are to achieve the performance targets that are set for us, based on our projections and plan and looking forward a number of years, then we will require significant investment in terms of staff. But at the moment, in terms of our vacancies in this council area, we are actually not too bad in terms of that. We're probably in some areas, Newry Station, for example, we would have additional paramedics than we're currently funded for, and we're doing that at risk, obviously. That's offset by some of the vacancies across the other areas. So we're probably, in terms of paramedics, we're at a net plus 3. Our EMT grades, we're probably looking there at about 6 vacancies, and our ambulance care attendants, 5. So whilst there are some vacancies, that's notwithstanding as well abstraction because of sickness, etc., and still challenges with staff who are not able to patient face as a result of COVID.
Thanks, Mark. Well, I, on behalf of the council, would like to thank you and Seamus for your presentations today. Obviously, you guys are very much at the coalface of what's happening out there at the moment. And I think given the rurality of the district in which we live in, you're vital in relation to our people and our citizens getting a first-class health, access to first-class health care. There are major concerns and major issues that you've outlined. And I feel that it's very important that the Department of Health and the Trust take on board those issues that you have raised today, and I'm sure you raise them on an hourly and daily basis with the Department, whether or not they're heard and acted upon is a matter for debate. But, you know, I think that there has to be joined up thinking going forward in relation to the strategies that have been advocated in relation to the reforms of our health service. And I know the Daisy Hill Future Group, see Carl on there today. You know, we're looking at this in the round in relation to the vulnerabilities that are there in relation to the availability of getting people to hospital, and the reliance that there is on any new models in relation to the availability of the ambulance service. And if you guys are stuck for 5 hours at Daisy Hill, for example, or the Ulster, that's causing significant issues in relation to accessibility for people in the area, which is significantly rural, to get to Craigavon or wherever those services are. But again, I would thank you for your dedication and your team for your complete and utter professionalism in our district. It's most appreciated. And I know that people, when they're received at hospital, the first people that they want to thank are the ambulance crews who were first on the scene and dealt with them. So I'd like to thank you and all your paramedic team for the work that you do, and wish you well for the coming years ahead. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
To follow up on something before you come offline, there's just one thing. Sorry, I missed them on the chat here. Sorry, go ahead on.
Thank you, Chair. No, look, Chair, I'll be quick. It was just to ask about the tax on staff that I was actually very shocked to hear about. That's putting people off and wanting to take that job and role, is there anything that we as councillors can do to help you guys and to help highlight that?
Thank you very much for that question. It's actually very close to me in that I chair our violence prevention reduction group in work as well. So anything basically that you can do to highlight the issue, and also in your role as an elected representative to actually, dispel the myth that exists that, you know what, it's all right to actually tell someone to Foxtrot Oscar or whatever you want, that that's part of your job. It's expected. It absolutely is not. From our control staff right through to our operational staff, the abuse can be horrendous and can go from that terminology right through to threats to kill. And we take a very strong approach to all of these, basically a zero tolerance approach. But the number of attacks now are getting to the region of 12 per week, which isn't very far away from 2 per day. And that's the worst it's ever been. Despite all of our efforts, our most recent initiative is body-worn video cameras, and we've piloted that in a station in Belfast and among some of our hospital ambulance liaison officers. As a result, that is now being rolled out right across NIAS. And I can imagine in local communities that could actually be seen as some sort of a negative, or there could be some sort of fear attached to why someone is using a video camera. So I guess in terms of your support for that, they only will be used when there's a threat or indeed there is actual aggression shown towards us. And there are very strict guidelines on what we do with the footage then afterwards. But yeah, anything at all that can be done to highlight that. And again, we're happy to come and meet in person with local community groups to discuss that and take that forward would be most welcome.
Okay, Councillor Lewis. All right, that's grand, folks. Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you.
Everybody, you're very welcome to this afternoon's meeting. I'd like to welcome Dr. Marie O'Kane, Chief Executive of the Southern Trust, Mrs. Leslie Lehman, Interim Director of Planning and Reform, Mrs. Trudy Reid, Director of Surgery, Mr. Brian Brady, Director of Adult Community Services, and Mrs. Catherine Reid, Interim Director of Medicine and Unscheduled Care. I believe that's the full tranche of everybody who is due to be with us today. You're very welcome, folks, and I'm happy enough if you wanted to proceed, I presume, with your presentations, and then I'll take comments and questions from councillors if that suits at the end.
Okay, thank you very much, and thank you very much for the invitation to meet with you this afternoon. What we're going to do is, because I know we have a lot in common to think about, and what we're going to do over the next number of minutes is just go through a presentation in terms of where we are and where we aspire to be. So Leslie, I think, is very kindly going to start off, and then I think other people will join. So Leslie is our Interim Director for Performance and Planning.
Thank you, Maria. Are you happy that I share a presentation to screen?
Yes, go ahead, Leslie, not a problem.
Can you all see my screen?
Yes, it's on our system, yeah.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the opportunity to come along today and present to the Council's special meeting, along with our senior management team today, are some members of our Pathfinder group and our community forum, Mr. Charles Hughes and Dr. Donald Duffin. So they're with the Southern Trust in this presentation. So hopefully I'm going to give you a bit of a summary of some of the challenges that we are currently experiencing, with particular focus on access to services, which I know was a particular area of our focus for yourselves, and a bit of a service update for our services in the Newry Mourne area. Would also like just to make a quick reference about our future working together in terms of what the next steps are for us. But I suppose the key challenges for us as a trust, like many other trusts, and you will have heard this from our colleagues in Southeastern Trust and indeed our colleagues in NIAS, are common issues to us all, and our key challenges are access to unscheduled care services and the flow through our hospital and health and social care systems. They are also around elective access for both urgent and routine patients, stabilising our workforce, and that includes attracting, recruiting and retaining specialist workforce and skilled and non-skilled workforce. And that's a particular challenge for the Trust at this point in time. And I think with all people, we can't ignore the ongoing financial position and uncertainty around that, and political uncertainty even around the shape of our health services, as well as the wider political agenda for us. All of these issues are reflected in our corporate plan, the plan that we've put in place for 22-23. This plan was an interim plan that we put in place, acknowledging we had come out of the pandemic and we wanted to give some direction and clarity to our staff on our key objectives. It wasn't a widely consulted plan, but it was a plan of necessity. And going forward, we want to look at our corporate planning process a bit wider than that. Our plan really focuses on what we're going to do, and who's going to do that, and our people, which is our 13,000 workforce that are citizens of the population of the Southern Trust and beyond, and all the issues around how we want to deliver care, which is around our quality and our safety as well. So the three priorities for the Trust going forward are really around stabilising, rebuilding and growing, and that was our post-pandemic situation, reflecting on our workforce and what we needed to do to make them feel safe and make them feel belong, etc. We wanted to pay particular emphasis to improving access to planned services for our patients, and they're particularly patients on our waiting lists. And our third priority was supporting unplanned emergency and unscheduled care services. So very simple, three priorities for us, which was really just about all focusing the mind and where we wanted to go. In terms of access to unscheduled care services, I don't expect you to be able to read this slide in detail, and I'm happy to send the pack on to you afterwards. But I suppose I just wanted to reflect some of the challenges that we face. And what I have displayed here is our performance against the targets that have been set for EDs across the region, both the target that people should be seen and assessed and a decision made within 4 hours, and that no one should wait over 12 hours for services in ED. In both of these areas, it is important to be able to see that our ED attendances, like every other area apart from the Children's Hospital in Belfast, have decreased in number. So the people coming to our ED departments is less, but our ability to perform against the standards is challenged. So the little reds here are showing that our performance wasn't as good. And that's about how our whole system flows through through the hospital service, community services and social services. So I suppose that the key thing that we wanted to sort of talk through today was how has that impact happened? And I suppose whilst less people are coming to our ED departments, patients who are admitted to our services are staying longer. They have an increased length of stay in our hospital systems. We have increased delays in discharging people, both people who are what we would call a simple discharge, that is a straightforward discharge home, and people who may need more complex services wrapped around them. So we have delays in effecting those discharges. We have challenges in our social care sector with capacity in our domiciliary care and in our private nursing home services and our residential home services. And all of that impacts on patient flow. And you'll have heard that those terms today. And that means that the people who present in our ED who need admission cannot get out of ED to an appropriate bed and ward. That leads to overcrowding in our emergency department. And that is how that challenge presents for us. So when we see the pressures in the emergency department, it's probably downstream of a lot of other challenges in our wider system. And one of those key messages for us, where we have been working with people in our services, is really to try and get people, when they're ready to leave our hospital system, to leave our hospital system when they're advised medically, and the trust will work with them to try and wrap around the services that are required. That avoids people staying longer than they need to, and for older people, staying longer in hospital can impact their health, but it also supports the reduction of the delays in ED, and it allows then NIAS to offload their ambulances and get back on the road. And that's, I suppose, how our whole system connects, and it's where we're seeing some of our challenges at this stage. This chart just shows a small representation of some of the pressures in our social care sector. And this upward trend and these little orange dots are the areas of concern that present by increasing demand for domiciliary care packages. And that is where we cannot get a package to meet the need of a person either leaving hospital or, more importantly, at home, to sustain somebody at home. So we are delivering more domiciliary care packages than we did pre-COVID, pre-pandemic, but our demand is greater than it's been before. So we are not currently meeting the need in that that area. And that shows how that impact is pushing right down to the front door of our service provision. And the things that we're trying to do around that, this year, as part of our unscheduled care planning, we've tried to focus in a number of areas, which is really trying to really do a lot of work around assessment when people first come to our services, making sure they're getting to the right part of the service, and trying to make a quick pick up into a short stay environment and move them on to another part of the service, rather than let them get into the hospital system to stay unnecessarily if that is not the right route for them. We also want to focus on that flow, and you'll have heard that mentioned, doing our best for the people in our services. And we also want to build that community capacity to both create capacity for discharge, but also to avoid admission where that is not the right route for patients to come to. So a lot of actions we have. And when we talk about access to services, primarily our larger volumes are in adult services, but we also have challenges with access to inpatient mental health services and children's services. And our focus has been about trying to prevent those admissions by greater access to same-day assessment ambulatory services that give a quick diagnosis, allow someone to get treatment and return home. So I suppose in terms of developing that, we have referenced across to a lot of planning and learning from other parts of the system, and we're working with all trusts to try and come up with proposals that prepare us whilst we plan for winter for other variants coming from COVID, look to increase in our capacity outside trusts, increase our resilience and response times by, you know, unblocking our system and allowing NIAS to offload patients and our ED services to focus on what they do best, to reduce that crowding in ED. And we know that overcrowding in ED brings risk to patients who are there and who are waiting. To try and reduce our hospital occupancy and reduce those length of stays and ensure that timely discharge, working across acute mental health and community settings and working with all our social care partners. Key to us is also providing better support for people at home, using technologies where we can, outreaching to people at home, and with some really good examples of that. And also to look at support for those folks who use our services more than others, so our high frequency users of services. So that's a few actions around our unscheduled care challenges. In relation to our elective challenges, I mean, fundamentally what you're seeing on these charts is an increasing trend. Those top two charts show the volumes of people waiting for services to access both outpatient and inpatient services. And the sort of the blue, which turns into orange, is happening around the same time, around November, December, and that's just at the pandemic period. But it's clear that the upward trend in folks waiting for our services was there before COVID. It has been exacerbated by COVID and has continued in an upward trend. This increasing volume of patients waiting for hospital services is a key issue for us, and it has many impacts. We also have seen over the past number of years, and more recently in the last year, an increase in those patients who are presenting with what we would call red flag, which is our most urgent query suspected cancer patients. So we are having more referrals. And the little chart at the bottom left with the orange dots is showing that now, as much as September there, we're seeing at least 500 referrals more per month for people who need that urgent, most urgent assessment. What that does for us now is displace routine capacity. We must attend to that first. So the impact of that is an increasing wait time for those, particularly on our routine wait lists, as we refocus all of the capacity we have to meeting the demands of the red flag and urgent cases. That also impacts as people who have been waiting longer on waiting lists then represent to us as emergencies. So there are some of the challenges that we're having through this increased demand and our inability to provide the services required for those waiting on our waiting lists. That first slide that I showed you was sort of general services, and these two charts are showing a similar pattern in our mental health services. So we're experiencing this challenge across all our service areas. Whilst we have been able to do some improvements in those areas, it has in the main not always been sustainable. We're trying to be innovative and creative in the things that we do. And my colleagues will give some updates, particularly what we've been doing around mental health. But we are seeing an increasing wait, particularly if we look at psychological therapies, which is a chart on the bottom right. It is increasing significantly, and that is primarily to do not just with demand, but an inability to secure the necessary workforce and skills to make an impact into that. So in terms of the actions around that, the Minister set out his elective care framework, which was about starting to rebuild and recover and redesign. And within that, there are a lot of really good actions to sort of reset elective care services. What we have in this year, we have seen £7.4 million of investment coming into the Southern Trust in the first 6 months of this year to buy additional services. And we've been able to buy additional services for 31,000 episodes. Most of those are direct patient attendances for outpatient or inpatient services. Some of them provided in our hospital services, in our community services, and some of them provided by our independent sector colleagues in private hospitals. We expect to have another £4 million coming in now in quarter three. We are not as clear about the funding position for quarter four of this year, just due to the current uncertainty. But again, we'll be purchasing services and providing additional services where we can. Part of the focus of that elective care framework is also focusing on theatre efficiencies in our wider system, whether they be outpatients or just using the best of what we have. So a lot of focus on that and sharing learning. Being really focused on our waiting list management, checking that those patients who do need care and are assessed as needing urgent care are getting that first, and that other patients in the waiting list are ready and willing to be called and can be expedited through that system as and when necessary. And some of the other parts of the system you'll be familiar with was the development of elective centres, and we've seen elective centres for day case hubs being set up in Lagan Valley and Oma, and more recently the overnight services for elective care being set up in the Manor and recently announced for Daisy Hill Hospital. So that has been a big focus of redesign and how elective services work. As part of that, there is also a strong performance focus on trusts performing at an optimal level and getting back to deliver services at a level that they were pre-pandemic. And over to the right, in terms, you'll see this red, amber and green section, which is us focusing on our own performance against where we were in 2019, which we're taking as our pre-pandemic year, and looking at, are we doing as well as we did then? Could we deliver more? And what areas we're struggling with? And there was many reasons why our activity went down. So that is a really key focus for us. And we have done really well in activity for our breast assessment services. Our mental health services are starting to work at the levels we would expect them again. And there's other really good examples. Some of our areas are challenged around allied health professionals. Again, access to staff, vacancies, vacancies in our consultant teams in adult outpatient services and some challenges getting access to our theatre list with dental services. Some of them in red are areas that we haven't been able to get to our level of delivery that we were. Cardiac cast services, we had some downtime in our capacity and we lost some capacity there, so we're refocusing getting that on track. Daycare attendances are not where we want them to be in the community. Some people have chosen not to come back to those services and we need to look at what we can do to make people feel safe and that is the right option for them. Ultrasound scans, for example, some staffing issues in there and some reprioritisation, as for example, we might move staff from working on that type of activity to work perhaps with CT scans or MRI. So lots of examples in there of how we're trying to focus on our delivery and there's strong oversight in that. In terms of Daisy Hill Hospital itself, there's a profile of services that has been developed to reflect all of the services and the activities and the development work there. And there's a little link and I'll send that to you and you can have a wee look at that. It's got examples of that. But what I wanted to draw attention to was some of the developments in Daisy Hill Hospital itself. This year we've been able to purchase the CT modular scanner and have that second scanner on site to provide a backup to the current provision that we do have. And that's very welcomed. We also have our case submitted and we're waiting our pending confirmation that we can go now to upgrade our electricity supply. That is a key part for us to then start to build further services and develop the site further. So we're very hopeful of getting confirmation of that in the near future. We have updated and resubmitted our strategic case for the Newry Community Care and Treatment Centre. And as is the process with the Department of Health, we will receive a round of queries and we're working through the first round already. We have in the 10-year capital plan from the Department of Health had indication that there is a funding scheduled in for the development of a twin scanning suite at the Daisy Hill Hospital, which will hopefully allow us to bring on greater diagnostic capacity. That is a sequence thing and will have to happen after we upgrade our electricity supply, but we're conscious of trying to plan ahead. And as well as that, on the 10-year capital plan, we have a strategic development of the Daisy Hill Hospital site. So there are a few of the capital updates. I'm now going to hand over to Trudy Reid, our Interim Director of Elective Surgery Services. That's not her full title. I let her introduce herself and she'll give us a wee update on service developments in the surgery and elective care. And then Trudy's going to hand over to Brian.
Hello, I'm Trudy Reid, the Interim Director for Surgery and Elective Care, Cancer and Clinical Service and Integrated Maternity and Women's Health. And thank you for having me today. In relation to acute services, in relation to emergency general surgery, as you're aware, we commenced our contingency arrangements for general surgery in February, and we continue emergency services on the Craigavon Hospital site with a number of patients each day. Approximately 3 to 4 patients per day come to Craigavon for their treatment. Southern Trust working with colleagues regionally following the publication of the review of general surgery on the 30th of June on how we locally implement the standards for our elective and emergency surgery, and we are progressing that well. The Southern Trust also working with the Department of Health to ensure that any local consultation on emergency general surgery will be informed by the wider Northern Ireland context, and continue to work closely with colleagues across the region. In relation to elective surgery, we're pleased that we had the overnight stay status granted to Daisy Hill Hospital. That's in addition to that previously granted to the Mater Hospital in Belfast. And we now work to identify the type of local and regional surgeries that will be undertaken on the Daisy Hill site. Currently, the surgeries that are undertaken in Daisy Hill include urology, breast surgery, gynaecology, ENT and dental services. The Department of Health has convened a meeting in November with the Trust to start working our way through the details of how that service will be shaped in the future. elective cesarean sections for mothers across the Southern Trust are carried out in Daisy Hill Hospital with the more complex ladies who may need specialist intensive care for themselves or their babies being carried out on the Craigavon site. But the services in Daisy Hill has been a very successful service, and we have regional dental service surgery for children provided on the Daisy Hill site. In relation to a surgical services, we are very keen to continue to develop surgical services on the Daisy Hill site with the recruitment of additional nursing staff, and we have a proactive campaign for theatre nurses currently being advertised. But some of that is dependent on our ability to be able to have affordable housing for that workforce. So we continue to work to recruit. Next slide, Leslie.
Rudy, I'm going to take it from there, if that's okay. Okay. Yes, you're okay. Brian Beatty here. I'm going to share some of the numbers with you, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
You're all right. I was just checking to make sure it was coming through. This slide's a bit busy. I'm not for a moment expecting to go through it in full detail with you, but just to give you a couple of highlights really from it. Starting up in the top corner, you'll see a small table with 136 on it, and it actually talks about looked after children. So that's for the Newry-Mourne area, just to give you a sense that at this point in time, we as a trust are involved in looking after 136 children. Now, the majority of those will be in foster care, but some of them will be placed in residential care, and we'll be key working with them to hopefully get them returned to their own families. Out of the 136 at any point in time, a small number will be in a shared care arrangement as they're starting to transition back into their original home setting. We are seeing an increase in those numbers over the last number of years, and that is a concern. It's an area of great attention for us, and particularly for the social work service who work with that group. The next line that you see, the little table, is 196. Those are children who are on the protection register. So in those cases, our staff will be involved in assessment, close working and partnership with the families, but actually we'll have a plan in place to monitor how things are going in those individual homes and with those individual children, just to ensure that they are in receipt of the care that they require, and that things are as good as they can be. Again, we are seeing these numbers increasing over the years. Those numbers I've just quoted, the 136 and 196, are for the Newry-Mourne area alone. The next table, again, just to give a sense of the enormity of the size of the business, what we're saying is on that table, the Newry-Mourne area, there are 87,000 plus hours a month actually delivered in Newry-Mourne, and they've been delivered in a partnership arrangement. Some are delivered by the Trust, approximately 40% of those, and 60% are delivered by independent sector providers that we work with. And many of you will be used to seeing people out on the roads, the various companies, etc., that are delivering that care. Again, that's Newry-Mourne alone. But just to give a sense of the size of the enormity right across the whole Trust area, in the course of a year, we oversee the delivery of just in excess of 4.06 million visits. So that's how many visits happen a year. Newry-Mourne obviously have their share of that. When you do the maths of it, it approximately equates to 3,285 visits a day. So even at the moment, our staff are out, independent sector staff are out delivering home care and domiciliary care, and that equates to around about just under 3,300 visits a day. Just to give a sense then of acute care at home, you'll have heard and you'll have seen at different times we'll have run our acute care at home service. It's a service that we're particularly proud of. We would suggest that we do it particularly well in the Southern Trust area. The other trusts are actually doing something similar, and we are all being brought to the place that they'll all do a similar service, so there's not a difference across the different geographical patches or areas. At this point, we are seeing an increase in the numbers that are being dealt with through our acute care at home team. And basically what we're doing there is a consultant-led service. There are allied health professionals and nurses involved. And care that previously would have been delivered in a ward setting is being delivered more often now in a community setting, in the domiciliary setting. We see it as the best way to do things. It's something that we're growing and ramping up and recruiting to. It's an area at the present time that's mostly focused on over 65s and those with a level of frailty, but very much managed by geriatricians. It is an area that we're exploring, and we expect to see in the very near future other service areas, whether it be respiratory, frailty, heart failure, other areas we'll see starting to expand in this area. And that will help to actually prevent some admission, but also to help earlier discharge from our very pressed hospital services. Also, that table at the top, you'll see under the domiciliary care, 87,000 hours, you'll see adult protection. So in the same way we've talked about child protection, just to the left of it, we also have adult protection. And there are examples where, as a trust, we're involved, we'll have plans in place, and we'll be monitoring the care delivered to some of our most vulnerable adults in our population across the various programmes. There are some numbers there just to give you a sense of the busyness of that. Those numbers are for the whole trust. They're not just specific to Newry Mourne in that case. At the bottom of the page, you'll see on the bottom left what we call a donut, the way we represent it. And that's giving for Newry Mourne an indication of those service users in the Newry Mourne area that are either in receipt of domiciliary care or in a nursing home or a residential home. So as you can see, the majority of those that are in receipt of what we call a care package are in receipt of a domiciliary care package. And that's just under 2,000 people in the Newry Mourne area, with 400 plus in nursing homes and just shy of 90 in statutory residential homes. Southern Trust and Newry Mourne in particular, we are probably particularly good at sustaining people at home. And our motto in the directorate, but also in the trust, is home is the hub. So we do everything we can to sustain people at home. But as already been covered by Leslie, that is not always the easiest thing whenever the demand levels are going up, and there can be a difficulty with recruitment at times. The last thing on that page that I want to share just briefly is the carers assessments. This is something that we do. So as well as assessing the service users, our patients as such, our clients, they go into the different terminologies, their names, we also perform carers assessments. So in recognition that the carers actually are under pressure and actually need additional support, we do this. What more can we do to support them in this very, very important role that they play? 1 week correction, the dates that are on the bottom of that, those there are 4 quarters, but the first 3 of them should have been dated 21, with the last one being quarter ending March 22. Just a little typo in our presentation there. Can we go on to the next slide, if that's okay, Leslie? I'm giving a very short update here because I know our time's tight, but just to give a sense, across 3 of our directorates, older people in primary care, mental health and disability, and children's, examples of what it is that we're doing, mostly working in partnership with yourselves or other agencies, but what we're doing outside of an acute arena, outside of the inpatient hospital arena, more so in the community arena. The first one under old people in primary care, I've already talked about acute care at home, and it's something that we hope will grow going forward. And it's very much a watch this space to see how much it is that we can do in that area. We've already acknowledged the pressures in domiciliary care, and really it's a story of recruitment, 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 as well as us recruiting care packages to ensure that people who maybe needed a lot of support at the time that they were discharged from hospital or at a point after a trauma, etc., just ensure that they are getting the correct level of care and that they're not either underprovided or overprovided for. If we find examples where people have improved, and we've done a lot through acute care at home or reablement services to help them improve their physical abilities, well, hopefully in those cases, we're in a position then to decrease the domiciliary care input that they have. And the time that we free, it isn't about saving money. It's actually about investing that in the next person, the person who's on the waiting list and in need of that care to help support them. Another couple of things that we will say, we have a lot of work going on within our Promoting Wellbeing department, where we work very closely in partnership with all of our agencies, particularly council, and that's in respect of health improvement work, whether it's tackling inequalities, in respect of social inclusion or ongoing support for community and voluntary sector. I have a list as long as my arm of the various projects that we're involved in those arenas. If anybody wants more, we can send that detail out. But we have great examples in each of the areas. I'm even thinking of one of the most recent ones that we're working with local leisure centres in Uriemourne to create warm spaces. And that's through a piece of work that we do under the banner of the Community Coordination Hub. And we're delighted to be able to work with the council and with Leisure Centre on that. We have other examples in each of our different service areas, whether it be in children's services or in mental health. We have examples where we have been working with, again, with the council, tackling inequalities and social inclusion, particularly with the Ukrainian Assistance Centre based in Uri. And we input to that along with our health visitors and district nurses and promoting wellbeing staff. We have staff inputting to the traveller and ethnic minority support working that's going on again with council. And we have also staff employed directly by us but tying in to the council services under the banner of the Neighbourhood Renewal Coordinator. And that's working across a list of different services, which I'm not going to go into the detail of. We're also, as a trust, working in partnership with the GP, Uriemourne and Banbridge GP Federation on multidisciplinary team development. So this is a project that's being rolled out across the whole of the region. Uriemourne and Banbridge are one of the seven areas that currently are in implementation. And we're implementing a higher level of staffing for social work assistant, mental health practitioners, physiotherapists, health visitors and district nurses to form a more wholesome, holistic team wrapped around the GP practice and wrapped around the population within that practice. The storyline that we talk about, going into the detail of it, would be under the banner of what we call population, mission population health. And it's actually making sure we tailor the services more specifically to each of the individual practices. And I'll pick that up later on if that's okay. We're also working currently with the region under the Urgent Emergency Care Consultation. We're awaiting an output from that that will include also an implementation plan, which will give us an indication of how best we will deliver in the future going forward our phone first or urgent care and the GP out of hours model and how they actually dovetail into emergency department, etc., and that whole piece of work. Mental health and disability, mentioned briefly, is very much of an upstream working. It's the push to try and do more of a preventive nature or very early on the journey of our service users. So we talk about new service developments in relation to steps to wellness, and really that's focusing on primary mental health and what they can do for those who are at an earlier stage of their journey, and we would like to stop it there, that they're not moving further into the services, that they actually get support early on, and by making right decisions and getting the right support, they actually develop their own strength and resilience and then do not end up needing a more intensive involvement at a later time. Obviously, there's work, again, that we do alongside yourselves and other agencies in relation to Protect Life and suicide prevention. And it is us working with you to look for more opportunities to engage with the wider population at the right time across a range of other venues. The details are on that slide. I'm not going to read them through line by line. We also are pushing more models. We're trying to build on the learning that we've had from COVID, the benefits of Zoom, even this meeting that we're having right now. But we're trying to bring that and mainstream it where possible into other approaches just to try and get as much activity, as many people supported as well as possible. Where people can be supported through this modem, we do that. But there still are many, many occasions when people need a direct face-to-face. So in some cases with AHP, physical disability, a new group clinic, that's the way that we're doing that. People that are coming along previously maybe are seeing a one-to-one, now are part of a group and are actually enjoying that level of comradeship and being brought together and being able just to talk through their own issues as a group. Learning Disability Centre, Leslie touched on it earlier, we are striving to get our activity levels back up to pre-COVID levels and beyond, and that's getting a lot of our attention. Children's continue to focus, and I've mentioned already, on foster care recruitment. We've done a lot to increase the level of foster care recruitment, but we need to do more because of the numbers that are coming through to us at this point. Our children's services work in collaboration through a group called the Southern Outcomes Group, but also voluntary and community, And again, it's all about about getting in earlier, the upstream journey, and working through the early intervention family support services. Other groups are given there as examples in relation to South Down Domestic and Sexual Violence and BCF Online. And these are groups that we're inputting to and continue to input to. Leslie and me are doing a wee tag team thing here. It's over to Leslie for a wee second and then they'll come back to me. Thanks.
Thanks, Brian. I suppose at the start I had mentioned our corporate plan, which was a 1-year interim plan. And it's just really to set out the scene that in going forward, we haven't had the opportunity over the last year to engage widely, but in going forward, we want to have a much wider engagement on what our services look like next year and beyond as we start working through those. We're very, very conscious of the changes that we're seeing to our healthcare system and the development of integrated care systems, where we'll see a change in our commissioning arrangements, and you will see area integrated partnership boards forming, which are bringing together a wider range of partners from the community, our community voluntary sector, councils, wider stakeholder groups and community representatives and general practice with trusts working together to really look at how we integrate care on a different level now, to look at different ways that we can look at the care provision through all levels of care, whether that's through community planning and living well in your community, or at the very sharp end of that acute inpatient care with specialist teams. And it's working through that continuum and making sure that we would consider services, we're considering all those things. When we look at that, we will, as Brian said, be focused in on a very much a population health basis, and that will require us to be really focused working with our partners at the SPPG and the Public Health Agency around our needs assessment. This chart actually shows a chart of Northern Ireland in the council areas and the wards, and the darker blues are where, for example, there is a much higher rate in the population of utilisation of ED. Now, that's an example for where we would start to look at that and saying, why would that be the case in those areas? Is it a deprivation issue? Is it a specific health need? Is this something to do with the community infrastructure? So that would be the start of our community plan and needs assessment, and getting right down into what we can do from the health and social care perspective to look after that population. Brian's team's been very much involved in the health improvement and the inequalities as well, and been focused on that.
Okay, and again, not to go into the detail, we're aware that we're putting a lot of information on the screens here, but this is a slide, very interesting slide, it'd be worth further scrutiny in your own time. I'm just going to give a quick indication in relation to it, rather than going through every line, but it's very much something that will help focus us on this population health mission and explain why it is that we are very much going to have to work together to get the best out of our systems, but also to tailor our services for individual council areas or individual trust areas. Really what we're seeing here is the information that we have available under a few banners for Newry Morning Down, but also then on the right-hand side for Southern Trust. At the top of the page, you see the red, amber, green boxes. I'm not being doomsday, but I'm going to focus just in the interest of time, just to give a sense of how we actually see that these boxes are of use to us, what it is that they're telling us. For Newry Morn, what has actually worsened versus what has actually improved against the Northern Ireland comparison? So what we're saying is, for Newry Morn at this point, we are seeing above Northern Ireland incidents and problems with respiratory admissions and under 75 admissions, and also circulation problems. We are seeing, if you go to the bottom of that, under the green, we're seeing improvements that it's less than Northern Ireland in respect of drug-related mortality, COVID-19 mortality, and drug-related admissions. So we're seeing better than the Northern Ireland average for those, but worse for the other ones. When you look across the right, and I'll go in there, you'll see for Newry, there was 15 areas that were worse than the Northern Ireland average compared to what you're seeing down the right-hand side. When you look down the right-hand side of that same page, you get a sense that what is an issue for the southern area is different than it is for the Northern Ireland as a whole. But what's different than for Newry and Moran, as per the left-hand side of the page, is even different than for the southern. So we, a southern trust approach by itself won't suffice. The challenge to us all is to tailor our services to focus on the individual needs of the Newry Moran area. And actually, even within that, what we'll be doing with the multi-D teams, we'll take it down another level. We'll actually take it down a level that we'll focus and tailor services specifically for individual practices within that. And that's our plan. That's our intentions. If you move down to the middle of that page, you'll see where it says comparison with the most deprived areas. These are hard facts, but they're actually giving you an indication there. If we just pick one or two to explain how to use that information. It's giving you for male life expectancy in the Newry Moran area. Deprived areas in Newry Moran as compared to the less deprived areas in Newry Moran. And depending where you live in Newry Moran, it can be a 1.8 year difference in life expectation for males, 0.8 years for females. You can compare that in your own time. You can see the story across. We actually have a worse story in the Southern Trust overall. So actually, Newry and Moran fare quite well compared to Southern Trust in Southern Trust comparison against Northern Ireland. But again, just take a little while to go over that again in your own time. The largest inequality gaps, so go back to the left in Newry and Moran, you'll see particular problems there in relation to drug, alcohol and teenage births. So that means in our response and our working with the council and other agencies, we need to particularly focus on those areas as we try to tailor our services. At the bottom of the page, you'll see then areas again where the inequality gaps have changed, either have improved or they have worsened. I'm leaving that slide there. Say that's probably best just to go through it a wee bit more in your own time. I want to then go forward and look at some of the opportunities, and this is where we'll have most opportunity probably to work in partnership going forward, whether through community planning partnerships or through initiatives such as the Peace Plus, which for people in the past that have worked through COT, it's an element of COT. It's a new program that's coming through. Now there's fuller information. There are various themes. There are six themes. We've got the detail of them there. Health and social care, we're particularly focused on theme four. Councils will be focused on other themes. Each of the departments are focused on various themes. But even when any of us are focused on a specific theme, the call and the challenge for us is to deliver on it. It actually is to work together in partnership as statutory agencies, whether it be council and health, education, Department of Communities, etc., but also in the community and voluntary sector. Leslie, can you just move me on one? And I'm nearly finished. I've just done our time getting away on us. That section, the theme that we're looking at, working through at the present time, it breaks out, and those are the list of the various aspects of the theme where we're expected to do something different, to do something more. There is money available. So at this point, the six border counties in Northern Ireland and the Republic are actually working together to see which of these themes and projects in particular could we bring forward together, whether there be a cross-border sense to it, or at least a cross-border sharing of the information to actually improve the lot of our population in each of these different areas. So there are innovative ideas being brought forward in each of those. That's my assurance to you at this point. And where it's relevant and where we can, we're working to secure help with our partners and agencies to bring them into being as soon as possible. I'm going to move us on to announce, Leslie, and I know we're working through and you're working through dates and one thing and another, but we are planning that there'll be a joint partners workshop during November, and we see that the focus will be on those areas that have been listed there in the bullet points. So we'll be particularly focused on our frail, the marginalised, the vulnerable in our community. We're striving to get better at using our information and tying into other information that's available to have a special focus on the people who are frequent users of services, just to see can we do something more upstream and preventive to save them having to go through that whole turmoil of making contact with emergency services very, very, very often in out-of-hour situations. And that's not an easy call for them. It's not an easy situation. We're doing what we can, and we'll talk it through at the workshop, what we can do to better wrap around and support people and coordinate our efforts to make sure we're getting best use of the scarce resources that we have, whether those be financial or staff. Also, to make sure we're making best use of technologies. I've mentioned Zoom earlier. There's lots of other technologies that we're now using compared to even 2 years ago in relation to condition management and monitoring. So we want to make sure we're making best use of those going forward, being innovative. And last but not least, we'll have a specific focus on social prescribing. And that's how, in dealing with our service users, we link them and signpost them to all the services that are out there in community and voluntary and any of the other partner agencies. It's an integrated journey. We're only really kicking off on it. You'll hear more about it, and hopefully we'll engage with more people at the workshop that's coming up. That's me finished. That's all of us finished now, but Dr. Maria O'Kane might want to say something just at the end. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Brian. I know that was fairly detailed over the last 40 minutes in terms of where we're seeing ourselves in relation to sovereign trust. I think the importance of presenting to the council is in relation to recognising that, you know, health and wealth are intimately interlinked, and that, you know, if we have a healthy Newry and Mourne, then we also have a prosperous Newry and Mourne. So it's really important that, you know, we are able to work and think with you about how, on a population basis, we provide, you know, really good, robust services and opportunities for people to improve their health. So thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to present, and we're happy to take any questions.
No problem. Dr. Maria O'Kane, thank you very much, and to all the team for and Brian for a very detailed presentation. What I would ask, if it was possible, to link in maybe with our marketing team. It's quite a lengthy and big file, no doubt, that presentation. If we could get a copy of it that members could go through, because there's a lot of detail to take in, and I know there's some members weren't able to make it tonight. First of all, I know there's a lot of change happening. I welcome the elective surgery decision for Daisy Hill. The more we can bring to Daisy Hill, the better. What I am going to do is highlight from my own perspective before I bring a couple of questions that have been raised with me and are in line with some of the questions I was going to ask. I have a fairly in-depth personal experience of both Daisy Hill and Craigavon in recent months. What I would say in relation to the surgical side of things and the oncology side of things in relation to my family, I can't fault the care that my family member has received from start to finish. One small issue I would raise would be sort of post-surgery, the requirement to travel from Newry to Craigavon for dressing of wounds, I think, needs to be reviewed, because I feel it's not a very comfortable journey for the patient, and I feel that that's something that could be done in Daisy Hill, and I think, along with the surgical team in Craigavon, I think that's a mountain that should be fairly easy climbed. In relation to the ambulatory referral, I recently had experience where I felt that the system that was put in place due to communication broke down. I had a daughter who was a suspected appendicitis. The care she received after a 7-hour wait in Daisy Hill, they scanned her, did all that had to be done, had to bring her back the following day, which I did. And there was an attempt to reach the surgical team for a referral the following afternoon, which I believe was the ambulatory proposal that was there to link emergency surgery on the surgical team to Daisy Hill. They struggled to get through and communicate. I arrived over and faced another 7-hour wait in paediatric A&E before she was admitted to hospital. So in my view, when I spoke to doctors who were dealing at the time, they said, when it's working exceptionally well. But maybe it was worthwhile somebody like me getting an insight that when it didn't work, that I can flag it up with you. There was an inability of the consultant who was dealing with my daughter at the time to get through and communicate, to sort of fast track or get that referral or review lined up at the other end. We'd already spent 10 hours in the system, and then had to spend another 7 plus an overnight stay. So that's something that I believe needs to be tweaked, and it brings me obviously to the whole issue around the emergency surgery. Obviously, the main concern we would have that Daisy Hill would eventually get past those problems, and we welcome the elective surgery developments that have come forward. But, you know, will that preclude the return of emergency surgery, or is that a potential opportunity with having surgeons on site that down the line emergency surgery could be returned to Daisy Hill? The other element as well, and again, this is something that I know the Daisy Hill Future Group has been looking at as well in relation to the infrastructure upgrades, and I'm glad to see those highlighted in your report today. But the whole issue around the diagnostic suite, we're looking at potentially 2028, 2029, from if I'm reading it right. I think there's a significant need to expedite that. For example, that we have our MRI scanner in our hospital for the treatment of our patients locally, and they can be assessed before being triaged, et cetera, and moved to wherever they get the best treatment. It's about working with yourselves and getting the best outcomes for our patients and fully understand that. And also really is to get an update on where the primary care centre is in relation to Newry. If it's still going ahead, and if so, what do we need to do politically to assist you in doing that, or have those proposals run out of steam, essentially? The other element then, just, and I'm sorry for hogging this, but I've had a fairly good experience of the system recently, and I can see the improvements that have been made. I can also see some of the little pitfalls, and feel as a duty to highlight those to you. In relation to the cross-border collaboration element, in relation to this, I see there have been bigger opportunities beyond Peace Plus, and those were in relation to a delegation that I had that met with the Health Minister in the South, Stephen Donnelly, and he appears to be very open to that collaboration developing further, and his department working closely with the Department of Health here and trying to get that moving forward for the benefit of everybody in the border region, and particularly the east border region where our natural hinterland would take across from North Louth into East Monaghan and North Cavan, as well as South Down, South Armagh and the Greater Newry area. But there are opportunities, I believe, as well through the Shared Island Unit. I haven't spoken to the Taoiseach and to the Shared Island Unit as well, where the research element of this funding potentially could be provided. So that may take pressures off trusts and off the Department of Health in relation to getting that work done on a cross-border collaborative basis, where that long-term solidifies the future of Daisy Hill. And if we're going down the elective surgery route, it may give more longevity to that proposal that was put forward there today on a cross-border basis as well. So those are just issues that I've been raised through colleagues and through my own experience in recent months. I can see some of the improvements that have been made. I have concerns, particularly around the emergency surgery side of things and the replacement or the communication mechanism that's there for referral, for review, surgical review at Craigavon, because in my experience, that broke down. So I would want reassurances that that will be looked at and where those pitfalls are, that they'll be addressed. Because if it became commonplace, then it sort of defeats the purpose of what was replacing emergency surgery at Daisy Hill. But those are the issues I would want to find. Some of them are questions, some of them aren't, some of them are observations. So appreciate you bearing with me.
Okay, thank you very much. That's a fairly detailed, I think, reflection of what we offer. But I'm very glad for the feedback, I have to say. I'm also encouraged that you're starting to see the benefit of the changes. And obviously, we would like those to go as hard and fast as they're able, but there are lots of factors outside our control in relation to that. Now, so to start at the top of your list, I'm heartened, actually, that surgery and oncology worked well for your relative. And you're absolutely right. We shouldn't be bringing people to Craigavon to have dressings done unless there's something specific about those dressings that can't be done anywhere else. But we can certainly look into that and think about that for the future, because actually the majority of dressings should be carried out in GP surgeries. They shouldn't even have to find their way to hospital premises. But again, we will take that off and explore all of that and try and understand what needs to be done where, because we don't want to inconvenience patients who are already feeling unwell. In terms of the communication breakdown in relation to your daughter, again, I am very sorry to hear that. What we do is a daily huddle in relation to the changes that we've made in relation to emergency surgery to pick up on these issues. So I am confident that that will have been fed back into the system and hopefully improved on, but we will go back and check because we don't take any of this for granted. And I think, you know, we have been working to best practice and best evidence across the rest of Ireland and the UK in terms of how we've put this together. And, you know, increasingly, particularly over the last number of years, we have become better competent at actually managing patients in the emergency situation to ensure that the transfers are safe and that we get the right patient to the right place at the right time. Because we know that given the distribution of our surgical colleagues currently, and not just in the Southern Trust, but across Northern Ireland, that your outcomes are better if you are seen by people who are expert in doing your particular procedure following a diagnosis. So what we're trying to do is make sure that we get the experts and the patients together in the right space. The actions we've taken in relation to emergency care don't preclude the outcome of the consultation. So the there will be a regional consultation on the provision of elective and emergency surgery across Northern Ireland. We had, obviously, with there being an absence of an assembly at the minute, that's probably a bit further delayed, but we would anticipate that that will come through again in the new year. So, again, we will be part of that in terms of responding to the consultation and taking forward, you know, the advice that comes out of that. But in the interim, because of the shortage of the provision of general surgeons, and given that, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, surgeons have been trained differently and that they're more highly specialised than they would have been in the past. And the surgeons that people would have seen in the Newry and Mourne area in the past, you know, such as Mr. Cranley and others, surgeons aren't trained in that way anymore. So because of the changes in training which have been across the island of Ireland and the UK, you know, finding the people with all the level of skills that we need to provide specifically in Daisy Hill has been a challenge, but we keep looking and we keep advertising with approaches to recruit. The primary, in terms of the low voltage cable then to the Daisy Hill site, we have been pursuing this very actively over the last number of months in particular. And we are at the back and forth stage now with the Department of Health in terms of finalising on the detail of that. I've had conversations with the Permanent Secretary and the Minister on a few occasions in relation to this. And the Minister was certainly able to assure me that this is nearly there. I think he had hoped to get it over the line before he finished last week. But we are expecting this imminently. And certainly whenever that's in place, and you know, me and my ignorance assumed it was just laying down a cable. I think it's a lot more complex than that. It will take a wee bit of time to get the structures and everything else in place. Once that is agreed and the detail of it is agreed, we will certainly pursue that as hard as we're able whenever we get the green light. And then that leads us into being able to provide more robust diagnostics and particularly an MRI scanner. So again, it's a stepwise process. Once we get the LV in place, then we'll be able to chase the rest. And we desperately want an MRI scanner on the Daisy Hill site for all kinds of reasons. But particularly as we increase the level of elective surgery that we do, we feel it will be certainly very helpful in terms of supporting the patients there. The primary care centre in Newry, Leslie might want to give a quick update on that in a minute, but that's certainly not off the page from our point of view. The cross-border opportunities that you mentioned, we are held by the rules of Northern Ireland. Okay, so we will pursue any opportunity that is presented to us and supported by the Northern Ireland Assembly and the health community in Northern Ireland. So I am very heartened by the fact that our colleagues in the rest of Ireland are keen to pursue opportunities with us, and certainly we would match the enthusiasm, but we need the framework and the opportunities to do things like that. We can't just decide to do it ourselves. You know, in the past, we have provided renal services to Northwest and we provide ENT services to Monaghan and Cavan. So, you know, any opportunities that are in there for us at all that we can work with, we will certainly take. The Shared Island Unit and Research, I know that certainly in relation to cardiology, we have the highest level of cardiology research across the whole northeast corridor of Ireland and into Scotland. We have used some of those opportunities before, but certainly we are a very research active trust, not just through medicine, but through nursing and the AHPs. And certainly any opportunities are there, we will certainly pursue that. And I will go back to them. We'll all go back to the guys that are involved to see if there's anything else in there that we haven't been using that we should have been using. So I'll pass over to Leslie, but just to say to you, all of these issues are very live for us. I'm delighted to get the feedback, even though some of it is very difficult to hear. But we will certainly pursue them and come back to you with comments in relation to that. Leslie, do you want to mention something in terms of the primary care centre?
Yes, thank you, Maria. Just to say, Chair, that remains a committed scheme with the Department of Health, so it is active on our 10-year capital plan for the Department of Health, so there is no lack of commitment to that. Time has passed from the original case was presented, and when it was refreshed, we have been asked to refresh our case and resubmit our strategic case, which has been done. So now we're in the first round of queries related to that. Typically, there can be two or three rounds of queries, which is part of due process with department, but we are anticipating that that scheme will progress. As I said, there has been firm commitment to the LV. The primary care and treatment centre is committed, so we have no doubt that it will be delivered. It's just a matter of when that will be started and activated, and it probably depends on just how long it takes to work through health economists and various people with queries. But we're confident that we should see something this year on that scheme in terms of a commitment to start the process.
Thanks, Leslie. Thank you very much. And thanks for your detailed response, Maria, as well for that. Much appreciated. I'm just looking here. There are no speakers or questions coming from members. Am I correct? Looking at the chat, or is anybody wants to come in? No. No, you've got off fairly lightly, so it's just as well. The issues when I maybe, sorry, Councillor Riley.
Yeah, Chairman, thanks very much. As you pointed out, it was a very detailed presentation from all the speakers. I just wanted to ask, is there any update on the Kilkeel out of our service? Will it be reinstated soon, or what's the present state of play there? I'm told that there are doctors who live locally in Mourne who would be prepared to man it, and then all you need is a receptionist, but if you give me an update on that, I'd be very grateful.
Brian, you want to I think Brian Beattie might be best placed to respond to you, if that's okay. Yes, Brian.
Very happy to. Kilkeel service continues on a temporary basis to be closed. The issue, and we've probably shared that before, Councillor, with yourself and definitely with others, was in respect of our inability to actually recruit sufficient staff to be able to man the whole of the GP out of service that supports the whole of the trust area. And at that point, I mean, I'm glad and I'm delighted to hear, and it may well be I get a wee chance separately than this to follow up, and you can tell me who these people are that specifically want to work there. But our issue was to provide the whole of the service, and I have to stress, by far the majority of the work that's done in this service, people are dealt with, responded to, and the calls resolved via the telephone. Probably something like 97.8% of the calls are actually resolved. So the primacy we have to give is to resolving the biggest number of people through the resource that we have. And the way that we did that was to decentralise, because the staff were telling us they're working out on an isolated approach that they didn't have others to consult with. So we made that temporary change. That allowed us to recruit some additionality and get people to sign up so we could manage the 97 point whatever percent that are dealt with on the phone, but also any of those who are requiring a home visit. So although we don't have somebody in the base every night within Kilkeel, if the person in Kilkeel, if it's judged after triage that they need a face-to-face visit in their home, somebody comes out and sees them in their home. There's been no impact on that part of the service. The part that we're talking about the impact on was the small percent, the one or whatever percent who are very important to us, but actually require to be seen at a base appointment. And our indication is that the last time when we looked at it, we are seeing good access for Kilkeel people coming in to Daisy Hill to the department there to receive that. So that's what we've done in times of difficulty, and it had been a service that was already under pressure. That's what we did to try and sustain it. We have seen some increase, and at this point, we're waiting to see the outcome of what was already referenced, the regional review of urgent care and out-of-hours care. We're expecting to see something about that very soon, and that'll give us a direction of travel, where we're going, and give us some sort of a sense of how many bases are right for a population such as ours. But I'll stress again, just in closing it, it's a temporary measure that we've taken at this point. It's not a definite thing.
Okay, thanks, Chair. Yeah, I appreciate that a lot of the issues are resolved over the phone. Sometimes maybe a mother of a young baby just needs reassurance. But there are other people who have to go on up to Daisy Hill into A&E, and that, I believe, that's contributing to the difficulties in A&E that we hear so much about. And it is very helpful if you have an out-of-hours GP in there, that if, say, again, a young mum presents with a child with maybe a respiratory infection or something, that you have a pharmacy there that you can dispense an antibiotic there and then. I think that would take pressure off A&E, and it's just such a useful service. You know, I'm sure you're tired listening to me saying about the road from here to Newry and then on to Craigavon. It's such a bad system, and there's no public transport network or anything like that for the Mourns area, which is essentially an island. But hopefully we can look forward to the future when we will get it fully reinstated again, because it was a very valuable service.
Okay.
It's definitely under review, and what I'll say just in closing then, Councillor, is as a Newry person, I have a heart for the Newry people. But a wee bit of clarity, when people come in to Daisy Hill, you made the link, DED, it's a separate stream. There are specific staff that deal with those people coming into an out-of-hours appointment that are different, just to make sure that we would avoid that extra pressure. I just want to give you that assurance. So thank you very much for your comments.
Okay. Are we any other councillors looking to get in? Sorry, Maria, do you want to come back in? No? Maria, were you looking to speak again?
Yes, please. I just wanted to take the opportunity when we're talking about the emergency department, right, just to re-emphasise what was said in the slides, because our levels of attendance at the emergency departments isn't increasing, right, because we have lots of things in place now to try and support people not to attend an emergency department. But what we know is causing the huge backward pressure is actually the discharge flow, right? So we have three times as many people delayed in hospitals, both Daisy Hill and Craigavon, than we had 6 months ago. And the difficulty with that is it's driving up the length of stay for patients. And that means, particularly if you're frail and elderly and you have completed your episode of care, it runs the risk of actually undoing a lot of good work if you're in hospital too long. So what we know is that if you're delayed in hospital after you're medically fit for discharge, you decondition, so you lose your muscle bulk, you're at increased risk of falls and confusion and depression and infection. So just, I know that the councillors are really, really important in relation to the wider public, and it's just to encourage people where they get the opportunity to take particularly older people home as quickly as possible to reduce the risk of anything happening to them that might undermine their health. And I appreciate that that can be difficult because of, you know, what Brian mentioned earlier on in relation to the shortage of domiciliary care packages. We are over providing domiciliary care packages, but we still can't keep up with the demand. And some of the care providers have handed packages back to us because of this whole awful situation with energy and food poverty, right? But, you know, 3/4 of a package is better than no package. So if that's what we can pull together, please take it and leave, because that will keep your person well. It will also mean that there's less back pressure on the emergency department, and then we can get people admitted. And it will get us away from having frail elderly patients on trolleys for hours and days at a time. So it's just to make that appeal to the councillors, who I know are intimately involved with the community and extremely passionate about improving people's opportunities, just to say, please encourage people to take their person home whenever they're well enough, because otherwise they're at increased risk of coming to harm, and also it means that there's a person in the emergency department who can't get a bed or off a trolley if they get delayed. So thank you very much for that.
Okay. I don't see any more requests for questions from the councillor group, so all remains for me to say is to thank you all very much for your contribution today and for what was a very informative presentation. And if arrangements could be made to get a copy of it, that we could distribute it to councillors so every one of them have the information provided today. But thank you very much for your time, and thank you for the detailed responses to all the questions and the issues you've raised today. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone.
Cheers.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you.